All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to a special edition of the Jim Fear 138 podcast with my good friend John Mollison. He is the narrator for Castalia House's audiobooks division, and he is a very good writer, and you should all go to Amazon right now and buy all of his books. He's got several out there. They're not expensive. Go buy them. John, how's it going, man?
Hey, it's going fantastic. Thanks for having me on. It's a real pleasure.
No problem. It's a pleasure to have you, man. So, you had some topics that you wanted to talk about while we were here, or did you want to just kind of let the conversation free flow?
Oh, I figured we'd just let the conversation free flow. That's how it usually works.
Okay.
I'm good with that. I mean, I want to make sure I get my plugs in. Sudden Rescue, tearing it up.
Mm-hmm. I heard that's been doing pretty good.
Dragons.
From
yeah,
you.
Yeah, it's been it's the most successful book launch I've had yet. It's only been out for about 2 weeks, and it's pretty well outsold everything else I've ever done. So can't complain about that.
That's awesome. Congratulations, man.
Yeah, it's been getting some pretty good reviews, too. Somebody said they described it as Edgar Rice Burroughs meets – it's what Edgar Rice Burroughs would have written right after he saw Big Trouble in Little China, which is a very Byzantine compliment, but was very gratifying because I love both of those things.
I'm definitely going to have to bump that up in my reading list then, because I bought it, but I haven't gotten around to reading it yet, unfortunately. My reading list is just miles and miles long, and it just keeps growing.
Oh, I hear you talking. This Pulp Revolution thing is just getting out of control, man.
Oh, it's just been killing my wallet, dude.
I hear you.
Seems like every 5 days something new comes out, and it's like, oh, I gotta buy this. My friend published this book. I gotta go buy it now, you know?
Well, and it's really all kind of coming to a head in the last couple of months. I think Jeffro's Appendix N, when that finally hit the market, that was kind of the dam bursting. You know, he'd been talking about it for a long time before it came out, and he had already kind of gathered about him an Appendix N culture. And we've been talking about the theory for a long time, but it wasn't for whatever reason. Maybe it's because of the lag time between realizing how it's done and actually producing the works. There wasn't a whole lot coming out. And it seems like just in 2017, all of those people that spent 2016 hashing out all of these ideas finally were able to put the finishing touches on their attempt at rebuilding what our culture has lost. And so it's all just kind of avalanching out right now, and it's glorious. It's so wonderful.
Yeah, it is great to see.
So many of us, I understand that this is a little before your time, but so many of us just turned our backs on fantasy and science fiction. You know, we clung to it as long as we could, and the culture of big publishing produced enough titles that made you feel like there was still some hope to be had there. You know, you had your Snow Crashes and your Anathems and your early Discworld books. But, you know, by and large, most of the time you came into the bookstore, even the used bookstore, you'd walk away with, oh, I heard things about this Scalzi guy. And then you'd read it and you'd think, I wonder what's on TV.
Yeah, no, I honestly had the same problem. Like, I'm as this has been going on, as I've delved deeper into this Pulp Revolution stuff and, you know, talked to all of you guys and been reading your blogs and all of that stuff, I'm looking back on, like, my history in science fiction and fantasy fandom, and it's always been something that, like I didn't know that cons existed until, like, 5 years ago. I just didn't even know that was a thing. I just read the books, you know, I would go into the book.
Sure.
That was what I was doing. The first job I ever got, you know, I was living with my parents. I ain't had bills to pay and shit like that. So what I would do is I would get paid, and then, like, every paycheck, I would immediately go cash it. And then I would drive like 40 miles to the bookstore, and I would spend like $60-$80 on books. And it was all sci-fi fantasy stuff.
Okay.
And when I would go out there, I would have a certain list of authors that I was trying to nail down getting their stuff. You know, Douglas Adams, R.A. Salvatore, Ursula K. Le Guin, people like that. And, you know, Dune, kind of these classics, Heinlein, stuff like that. And I would look at the rest of this stuff and it would just seem so generic. Like with books like Dune or, you know, A Wizard of Earthsea, or just about, there's some caveats, but just about everything that Philip K. Dick wrote, you know you're going to get a good book when you slap down your $8 or however much you're paying. Even with R.A. Salvatore, mm-hmm. his stories are still fun to read. With all of this other stuff, it's just a bunch of people that I've never heard of before, because like I say, I wasn't keeping up with the scene or anything like that. And the covers, yeah, okay, you've got some cool art here, but how do I know if I'm going to actually finish this book when I start it? You know, because there's a money investment and a time investment. So I'd rather just buy something that I know is safe. And occasionally I would pick up something. It's like, oh, this looks kind of cool. And, you know, I did the same thing that I did when I went to buy CDs. I would look at the cover art. If I've never heard this band before, I would look at the cover art or see something out of the corner of my eye on the shelf and pick it up and be like, oh, this is really kick-ass cover art. There must be great songs on here. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, I was right. But there's always that one time. And, like, after I got into the creepypasta thing, I started listening to a lot of narrations of stories because, like, holy shit, there's more to this than just a bunch of goofballs reading scary stories on the internet. You know, there's actually people doing audiobooks, and there's actual podcasts out there that I can listen to while I'm working that are reading stories. And I would listen to, like, Lightspeed, and, you know, I could probably rattle off, like, if I want to sit here and think about it, I could probably rattle off, like, 5 different podcasts that I used to listen to that I don't anymore. Because, you know, after I found you guys, I started reading Burroughs and Howard, and, you know, I read Brian Niemeyer, and this stuff that is coming out of these podcasts is just so bad, like so blindingly bad. And I was hanging around for those like 2 stories that they would put out every like 3 months that were actually good. And I would listen to mm-hmm. miles of this garbage, like just hours and hours of this garbage. And eventually I just got sick of it. I got so tired of it that I was just like, screw it. Threw up my hands, done with all these podcasts and it's not the fact that they're leftist, you know, or they have lefty leanings or whatever. It's that the fiction that they're publishing is crap. You can write a left-leaning science fiction or fantasy book or story, and it'll still be great, you know, just so long as you're telling a story and not publishing propaganda, essentially. But, you know, I would just rather, like, I decided I would rather give my money for audiobooks that I can listen to, like, get something from Graphic Audio or get an Edgar Rice Burroughs, you know, anthology on audio or something like that. And even now, I'm still subscribed to a couple of, like, they send you emails, and it's like, hey, these stories are on sale on Amazon, and I'm signed up for, like, horror, science fiction, fantasy, like, and then some, like, historical stuff and literature, and, like, 9 times out of 10, I don't even look at the books. I just, like, look at the cover, read the description, it's like, nope, 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 delete email.
Yeah, once you know to look for the warning signs, you start seeing them all over the place, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Once you get that little eye drop and you start seeing clearly, it's scary how much this stuff is permeated. Because, like, almost all of the science fiction and fantasy books that I get in these email services are, like, you know, oh, there's a woman on the cover and she looks really badass and it's talking about how she left her tribe or she used weapons to defeat, this is one that I saw earlier today, she used weapons to defeat this invader and save her tribe, so they ostracized her, they kicked her out, and now she has to live out in the wilderness. And I'm just like, yeah, I'm already bored.
Yeah.
I'm just gonna go read Princess of Mars. You. Screw this.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and that's, you know, what's interesting now is that I'm seeing more and more new names showing up, and I absolutely love it. There's a couple of short story anthologies that are in the works that I've submitted stories to. One is, what's his first name? Brian Beatty's Story Hack?
Oh, yeah, I missed the deadline
on that. Action adventure. And, you know, it's a lot of the usual suspects that, you know, from the pulp revolution scene, but there's a number of other people. And then Misha Burnett, author of the excellent Cat Skinner's book, is putting together a he asked the sort of conversation starting question, hey, can you do pulp action in the 21st century? Well, Thoreau was there saying, I got a blog post that covers that. And so Misha kind of threw down the gauntlet and said, okay, prove it, people. You know, I've worked with a number of collections, and he probably had, you know, 8 to 10 people say, yeah, I'd be interested. And then suddenly, once you get that kind of critical mass, there's probably another dozen names that are in and talking about it and excited about writing 21st century action adventure, maybe a little bit of weirdness thrown in for the sake of, you know, weirdness and for the sake of fun. But it's gratifying to see that kind of exponential growth. And, you know, I hope people start to recognize that the issue now is going to be we're moving to an embarrassment of riches. If we get another dozen Rawls, then that'll be fantastic. I'll never run out of reading material again. And at some point, you know, you're going to reach the point where you just can't keep up with it. You just can't.
Yeah. I mean, I've never really had the problem with buying more than I can consume, though.
Sure.
You know, especially when it comes down to this, because not only do I agree with what they're doing, I also like these people a lot and I want to support what they do. So I have no problem shelling out the, you know, $5 or whatever for the ebook when they finally publish it.
Sure.
Even well, if, I've had even if I never get around to read it, you know, I still want to support
Answer on my Kindle for like 4 months. I got 2 chapters in and I thought, you know what? I need help. I'm going to wait until the Puppy of the Month book club can read this so I can have Nate Housley and the Frisky Pagan kind of help me through. I mean, it's a great book and it's a lot of fun, but it's one of those books that there's a lot of stuff kind of going on under, you know, like the duck, proverbial duck on the water. There's a lot going on under the surface, and I'm smart enough to recognize, oh, that's a reference to a thing that I don't know what he's talking about. So I stopped, and actually this month, I think it was Nate selected it for the Puppy of the Month. And I'm really looking forward to hearing what those guys have to say, because it's just it's the Puppy of the Month book club is an extraordinary way to read books, because it's, well, first of all, it's not like the chick lit book club where it's an excuse to drink. You actually read a book and then you talk about it with people, and you get so much more out of it when you do that. And that's really why I started it, because one of the things that astonishes me is, you know, particularly here in the aftermath, we're all kind of, you know, we've signed the peace treaty, so with the hard buds of science fiction, and we're all kind of basking in the glow of not fighting about hard science fiction anymore.
Until Daddy Warpig releases another blog post, at least.
That's true. And then I'll sigh and I'll pull my combat boots back on and grab my rifle and head back to the front lines. But what astonishes me are the people that say, why are we talking about this? And I think, because we're fans of this stuff. You know, when I left college, I didn't have, and I went to the land of Normieville, and I'm in the office, and people say, hey, did you see the rap battles on the television last night? Look at this YouTube. And I'm an old, boring man who sees celebrities, and they're so thrilled because there was a surprise from Pop-Tart number 211, and I think, I have absolutely no idea what's going on here. And then you turn around, and someone says, how was your weekend? And you say, oh, it was fantastic. You know, I got into a Twitter fight about how Edgar, you know, about how Michael Moorcock's Elric is really just a cheap imitation of Conan, and he cheated in order to make it work. And they look at you the way you look at them when they're talking about Kardashians. So to be able to have these conversations with people is just so gratifying to me. And even if all that winds up if all of these pulp revolutionaries put up books and they're all terrible, and you know, it completely fades, and it turns out that the naysayers at File 770 are right, I don't care. I have people to talk about this stuff with, and I'm always trying to encourage more people. Listen, if you're on Twitter and you see the hashtag Pulp Revolution and you ever read an Appendix N book and enjoyed it and you have something to add to the conversation, do it. That's the whole point of fandom, is to get together and talk about the things you like. So
I mean, you have to have people to talk about the things that you like with, or otherwise your head is just going to fucking explode.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's so much good stuff. And now we get to talk about the old stuff. We get to talk about all the new stuff coming out.
Yeah. So, and I mean, like, honestly, honestly, I'm not worried at all about this fizzling. Because Jeff Rowe's book is so inspiring. Like when I read it, I would have to stop every time I finished a chapter. It's like, okay, we got a new chapter. Time to go to Audible. Time to go to the Amazon Kindle store and see if I can get these books. And if I can't find them there, then I'll go into the Amazon used section and I'll compare that price with ABE books. And then I'll like set up a want list and stuff like that. And just like, I have so much stuff on my Amazon wish list now that's just Jeff Rowe's recommendations. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. So, and it's like dark chocolate where you eat a little bit and you just have to wait because you just can't, you got to take it. I haven't finished the Appendix N book yet for the same reason. Cause I read a chapter and it just hits you. And you walk around like Neo, you know, walking around outside the Matrix for the first day, just, you know, with these stars in your eyes, and everywhere you look, you're looking at things and going, oh, yeah. So I know exactly what you're talking about. And
oh, no, man, I devoured that thing. Like, I read it in like 3 days. You know, I was like, okay. I was like on my lunch break. I took my Kindle to work. I was on my lunch break just reading it. But every time I got to a new chapter, I would stop and see if I could find the book that it was talking about. Because I knew that if Jeff Rowe was talking about this, whatever his analysis is, I want to read this book too. So
yeah, well, and part of a big part of my most recent release, Sudden Rescue, ding, was as I'm writing the book, the actual genesis of it was, I think it might have been Daddy Warpig who said one of those guys, one of the usual suspects, said, how come there's no more space princesses?
That might said, actually yeah, have been Jeff Rowe. Jeff Rowe was banging on that drum for a while.
Well, and he was also banging on the blue collar heroes. And I said, yeah, I want to write a book about blue collar heroes, about a blue collar hero that saves a space princess. And so I sat down to write about a space. And it seemed like it takes about 6 weeks to write one of these things. And every week there'd be a different point where, you know, Jeffro would say, hey, how come there isn't more romance? And if you've seen his recent live blog of watching the Iron Fist TV show, that's one of his big beefs is that the writers basically took a man and a woman and like a Ken and Barbie doll, just kind of bonked them against each other because apparently that's what they think romance is. And so I said, yeah, I need to have some romance. I need to have a little more romance. And one of the big things in the book is, well, how is this space trucker going to wind up with this space princess? I mean, part of the whole point of the story is that she had been captured by space pirates and he's got to get her back to safety. But A, they don't know where safety is because they think somebody hired the space pirate to kidnap her. And B, he kind of falls for her through the adventure. And, you know, what's going to happen when they do get back and he has to just turn around and walk away? So that's a big part of the drama of the story is you've got these genuine people who face a genuine issue and are told, you know, partially by society, but partially through their own expectations of, you know, he's a blue collar worker. She's a white collar princess. You know, so they've got these things working against each other. And that's one of the undercurrents flowing through the whole book. Not big. I mean, it's not a romance novel, but that's one of the ingredients of a good story is it. And what could be more relatable than two people who want to be together that are constantly being pulled apart and who don't even think they can be together. So, you know, space pirates, you know, the genocidal space robot army, those are all well and good, you know, fist fights and weird mechanical robots and all that stuff, you know, gunfights and bar fights. That's all good stuff. But, you know, without some reason behind it, without some meaning behind it. And I've dabbled in the new pulp tradition. And there's some very good writers in the new pulp that write very good action, but the people don't resonate. The people just come across as peg people. Again, they're Ken and Barbie dolls that kind of Yeah, they just kind of bounce off each other because, okay, now, you know, they also suffer because they think they need to adhere to the modern zeitgeist of non-people behaving in ways that people should behave. And I'm not interested in stories about how people should behave, because if they're behaving the way people should behave, they're not behaving the way people do behave. And when you write stories that take from that point of view, well, she has to be a really, you know, kick-ass girl who doesn't need no man. Well, I'm sorry, but, you know, sympathetic women need a man. You know, that should be one of the things that motivates them, is finding a good man. And if they don't need anything, then there's no drama. It just sucks it right out of the story. So I have a princess who needs a man. Now, in her case, it's because the whole universe wants her dead, and he's the only guy that can save her. At least that's how it starts. But then through the course of the story, this is a girl who's surrounded by vapid princes. And when she meets an actual genuine blue-collar guy, she's intrigued by what he represents. So, you know, the New Pulp, they're the same way. One of the stories I read, this is a classic example. The hero has rescued the girl from kidnappers. And they've wound up in this weird kind of like pirate town in the middle of a jungle. And she gets taken by the leader of the pirates into his sanctum sanctorum. And the hero's worried the whole next day, and he's got a plan for breaking her out. Well, it turns out that she seduced the pirate captain, and she didn't need saving. And so now where's the drama exactly? You know, you didn't set up any drama. You made it so that she doesn't need anything, but she's the one that's supposed to motivate the story. It made no sense to me. And you see that constantly these days. So that's one of the great things. So that's an example of Jeffro pointing out one of those things, and then me turning around and going, oh yeah, I got to make sure that I incorporate that into the story. And, you know, likewise, go ahead.
Well, like I said, go on from my earlier point, like the stuff is so inspiring nowadays, like with Jeffro's Appendix N book and all of the discussion that's been going on, it's very inspiring. And we also have a lot of very good people that are, you know, I would hesitate to include myself in this category, but people who are competent writers, who kind of understand how fiction ought to be, you know, because there's a very clear divide between what ought to be and what, you know, what is right now. And that's kind of reflected in the sales numbers of fantasy and science fiction on Amazon, at the very least. But all of these great revolutions in, you know, in fiction writing, it all started with these cabals of people who just were into the same kind of thing, and they got in touch with one another, and they started meeting up, and they started talking, and they started sending letters to each other, like H.P. Lovecraft with his Weird Tales crew, and the early Science Fiction Writers Association, I guess. I don't know if it's the same organization that it is now, but, you know, people like Philip Dick and Robert Heinlein and people like that getting together and talking about science fiction stories. And these people went on, they all went on in their own way to create a revolution in fiction and became not only wildly successful, maybe not necessarily in their own time, but certainly later. And they also went on to revolutionize whatever genre of fiction that they're working in at the time. And I think with all of the buzz that we're generating, which is small now, but it's growing, and with all of the good discussion that we're having between, like, the pulp revolution and the superversive people, or, you know, whoever might want to thrust themselves into the conversation, I think that there's no chance. Like, this is just the perfect time right now, the perfect convergence of events. We're striking while the iron is hot. Mm-hmm. We've already had the discussion. All of the blog posts are out there if people want to go back and read them. TradPub is dying. It is dying. It is killing itself slowly. And all of these people are, like Brian Niemeyer has said before, they're the mammals running around the legs of the dinosaurs, you know, the quick mammals and the slow dinosaurs. So the slow dinosaurs are dying out, and the quick mammals are rising to prominence. So if we continue to strike while the iron is hot, if Castalia House continues to grow, if outlets like Kirsova and Story Hat continue to grow if Misha Burnett publishes his anthology of neo-pulp stories that he's putting out. And all of this keeps going and keeps going, and we continue to prove ourselves essentially on the field of battle, then I don't really think we have any worry about this dying on the vine, so to speak. It's just going to be undeniable because the quality of the fiction is so much better. Let me take you as an example. Like I said, I had been listening to these podcasts and everything like that, for months and months and months, and it was just schlock after schlock after schlock. Then I start reading King's Dragon, and I'm like, oh shit, this kind of fiction still exists. This is good. This is damn good. You know, I haven't even gotten to the conflict yet, but I already love the story. It's amazing, and it's written very well, and the characters are real people, and they react the way you would think real people would react, and even the background characters are realistic, and it's so well written, I can't wait to read the rest of it, but I keep getting distracted. I'm an addle-brained fuck. But, like, if we have stuff like that, especially stuff that's coming out in anthologies, that's going to get chopped around cons, that's going to, you know, create buzz on the internet, that even the people at File 770 are going to be talking about because they hate it so much. That still generates buzz for us. There's going to be like five people that go read that File 770 post disparaging Misha Burnett's, you know, anthology, that are going to be like, well, I want to go see what's up. And then they go and read it. Yeah. And I have perfect faith that it's going to be undeniably good. And then, boom, we just got five converts out of some idiot at File 770 hate blogging us.
Right, right. And I'm also gratified by – I've seen a couple of more established authors, like David J. West has kind of taken note of the pulp revolution. And even Barry Reese, although he's not quite as amenable to what we're selling, but these are guys with established fan bases that have seen what we're doing and are interested enough to kind of poke their heads in and say, oh yeah, this is exactly what I've been looking for. This is what I've been doing. So, you know, that's reassuring to someone like me who's done
very enthusiastic.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, but it's which is natural because he's part of that Utah science fiction writers, along with the Mountain That Writes and Torgerson, who are friendly and allied, if not completely on board. I want to go back to one thing you talked about, and that's the revolutionary nature of the cycle of science fiction. That, you know, you had the Campbellian Revolution, and then the Futurians was a group of guys that came out and pushed back against the engineering aspect of the Futurians. And then the new wave guys came out and said, well, you know, as a pushback against the Campbellians and the Futurians. And then you had the, after the new wave guys, you basically had the SJWs push back against the new wave.
Mm-hmm.
But ours is a little bit different in that, let me back up a step. Every single one of those revolutions, and Daddy Warpig pointed this out, looked back to the pulps and said, wow, you know, I want to do what they do, except I want to take out this aspect of it. And we're the first ones looking back and saying, you know, I want to do what they do. And that's it. So it's interesting to see, you know, that now this, you know, this is the actual cycle. It is going back to the stories that have the action and that speak, that feed your heart, body, mind, and soul. And each of those waves that came through added a little something, but they took something else away. And if we can go back, I like guys like Carl Gallagher and John C. Wright pushing back on the anti-hard science fiction thing, because they do have some very good points. And I like guys like Misha saying, you know, you need to stop throwing the new wave under the bus. They actually were looking back to the pulps because they missed the kind of wahoo, you know,
insanity.
What would you say? Yeah, well, just as far as the tech, you know, the new wave guys were really concerned about identity and relationships in a way that the Futurians and the Campbellians weren't. And you need that in your fiction as well. So, but it's, you know, it's another case of you don't need to reinvent the wheel. If you want to know how this is done, People have already done it. Just look at what they did and do what they did, and you'll be fine. And you don't have to write a 1950s bug-eyed monster story. You can write a 2000 teens bug-eyed monster story just fine. You know, there's a certain arrogance that we have. Well, I have a cell phone, so, you know, I'm not some savage that has to find a phone booth to communicate with somebody. Well, hey, you know, you're a writer. Okay, that's a problem, is that help is always a phone call away. Fix it. Use your imagination and fix it. There is room for adventure all around us if you are creative enough to find it. And that's why I'm looking forward to this future and this modern day pulp anthology, because I want to see how other people have solved that problem.
Yeah, honestly, I've got a series of stories that I was writing in college. That I've lost almost all of them. Like, I don't know what, this is just like the thing that's fated to never be. But, I've got a series of stories that I really want to get back to writing, and I'm thinking about, typing up a new one for, Misha's thing. Cause I submitted a story and got rejected cause I didn't get the whole, like, oh, this is supposed to be set in the 21st century kind of thing. So sure. I submitted like classic fantasy stories. It was, in my opinion, it was a pulpy story. It was mainly focused on action, very tight focus and everything, but it wasn't the setting that they were looking for. So I've got this idea, and I don't know how deep I should get into it, but, you know, maybe somebody else can take parts of the idea and run with it if they feel like it. But I've had this idea for the longest time about a series of stories, because I'm constitutionally incapable of writing a novel, but, about a rogue arm of the Confederate government that is still active in the American South. And I kind of got inspired by Torchwood. I watched that series and just absolutely loved it. But I thought, well, what if we had that in America, but they weren't working with the federal government? And then I hit on the idea of there were two governments in America at one point. So what if back when they were putting together the Confederacy, you know, I want to say it was Lee. I don't know. I've had a couple. Lee was the general of the Confederacy, right?
Right. Old Jeff Davis was the president.
Yeah, Jeff Davis. So, like, my basic premise was Jeff Davis and General Lee created this special division to deal with paranormal threats to the Confederacy. Like werewolves, vampires, you know.
Voodoo, come on. New Orleans, yeah. Right there, man.
Yeah, voodoo, yeah. Definitely. That's something that I hadn't thought of. That's a really good point. And through sheer fuckery, because it was done through this one family, the family kept it going, and they remained loyal to the Confederacy throughout all of these years. And now it's kind of falling apart. It's only got, like, one division. You know, it's just like five people that are trying to essentially save the modern South from demons and ghosts and vampires and zombies and werewolves. And you know, I had this whole plot about them going out and forming new chapters, and I still want to get back to that because I really like the idea that I came up with for where vampires and werewolves came from. But you know, I've been thinking about revamping that and submitting that to Misha's thing, just to kind of like get back in it. Cause that's a series of stories that I really want to write. And I think I can go places with it. I just don't know if they would be, you know, amenable to that kind of thing. But so far as I know, so far as what Misha has told me, all of the gloves are off.
Yeah. That sounds like it's right up their alley. And the fact that you've got a legacy Confederate organization that is actually the good guys is so trollish. I have to applaud you for that. That's beautiful.
Well, if there's a
Northern Carpetbaggers Association who are just degenerate bad guys that they kind of have to stop through the course of this.
Well, in my planning on this for, you know, like in the future, like I never planned very hard on what I'm going to write, but one of the ideas that I came up with was eventually the government was going to notice that they're like running around the streets of Raleigh in like the middle of the daylight, like shooting demons and shit like that. Eventually they're going to notice and like kind of dealing with those, like you brought up the whole, help is a phone call away thing, like them dealing with people live streaming the events and shit like that. And mostly they kind of piggyback off the federal government, saying that it was like, you know, the government comes out with a story, oh, it was a shoot for a movie, you know, no one was harmed.
Right.
It was just all this, you know, they just kind of piggyback off that and just remain as far under the radar as possible. But eventually they're going to be found out. So that's kind of, I don't know how I'm going to deal with that yet, but
well, listen,
I'm certain that the story will reveal itself to me.
That is a grossly untapped market. You know, for all of the origin stories that we have to have because every movie has to follow the hero cycle, that notion of the day that it becomes blatantly obvious, it can't be hidden anymore, that aliens walk among us, that demons walk among us, and how does that affect society, and how does the changing society affect the hero? You know, I can see a vast untapped reservoir of ideas there. Just the fact that this hero has dedicated his whole life to saving the planet and never getting any kind of accolades, and then suddenly everybody knows who he is, and he has to deal with the fact that half of the people, and remember, half the people are idiots, so half the people are going to be mad at him for lying to them for the last 30 years, even as he always gets the best table at half the restaurants in the town, because, you know, half people would be like, oh, so that's why we're not dead now. Thanks. You know, yeah, we always have room for you, Mr. Savior of the World, the dozen times over. And then he goes out on the street and people are spitting at him because he's been lying to them. That's the kind of thing I'd really like to see. Why don't we do the origin of, you know, this birth of a brand new world? It puts, you know, most of the other technological revolutions to shame, because that kind of information atomic bomb, I think that'd be fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I know that it's taboo to bring up Marvel in the circles that we run in, and I spend a lot of time online shitting on Marvel, just deservedly shitting on Marvel.
Justifiably so.
Yes. But, like, the Civil War arc that they ran through, I really, really like that arc. It was really fucking incredible. Like, the first time I read that, it was just like, holy shit. Because, I mean, it starts off with what is essentially a terrorist attack. Like, I don't know if you've read it. Have you read it?
Yeah.
Yeah, you remember the
well, listen, like, listen, I didn't read it, but I hang out with nerds, so I've read a lot about it, and I know all the nitty-gritty details with all the speedball and all of that.
Yeah, yeah, like he crashes into the side, he gets crashed into the side of a school bus and blows it up and kills a bunch of school children. And it's like, holy shit, this is something that Marvel has never touched before. Like, they've had people die in their comics before, but they've never killed children.
Sure.
And having that start the story off, and then it just gets heavier and heavier and heavier until you've got like 400 superpowered beings just duking it out in the streets of Manhattan. And then Captain America wusses out and gives up, and I don't really like the ending, but you know, the whole arc was very, very impressive, and how they dealt with all of the modern day problems and like the media and, you know, people who were involved in tragedy becoming political actors. Like one of the kids who died, his mom becomes one of the big pressures on Iron Man. I thought that was I don't want to say masterfully done, but very well done. It was enough to keep me, you know, reading.
Sure.
So I don't know, just like taking modern day stuff, you have to be careful though, and that's one of the things that I think that they did right in that, was they didn't exactly tie it back to like Black Lives Matter or a civil rights struggle. Like, they created their own little story for this world, and they took in themes that we're dealing with in modern day, but they interpreted it in such a way that it works in the fictional universe that they're talking about. So we're not talking about Black Lives Matter in Chicago and Luke Cage is hired by the government to go in and, you know, quash a BLM riot or something like that.
Right.
It's this very organic thing. And I don't know. I think that's a good example of what you were talking about, but maybe I'm completely off my rocker here.
No, it absolutely is. And listen, they had the sales numbers to prove it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think if they'd left it, if they just said, yeah, okay, you know, there may be some allegories here, find them yourself. But towards the end, they kind of ran off the rails because the writers decided they knew who was right. And which is always a problem when you set out to make a nobody's really right and nobody's wrong, and then you pick a side. When your writers pick a side, then you've kind of devalued the whole initial premise.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to completely shift track here, and I want to talk about.
Oh no, go ahead. We were running out of steam there.
All right. Well, I want to talk about the Super Versus because I love the Super Versus. Those guys are great. I really admire what they're doing. Now, for those of you that are just tuning in for the first time, the Super Versus are a collection of authors who are they're mostly established, aren't they? All pretty well established. El Jazzy Lamplighter, John C. Wright. So. Who else is in that crowd? Anthony M. Most of these people I know about because of the recent hard science fiction dust up. But their whole premise is that it's the opposite of subversive. They want fiction to deliberately reflect the higher powers of the world, and generally that means it's a Christian allegory. And you know, John C. Wright's works are amazing. I absolutely love reading John C. Wright.
But I will say that they do mention specifically in some blog post somewhere that I remember having an impact on me when I was first discovering the superversive movement. They do say that it doesn't matter what kind of higher truth you're trying to put forward in your story. If you're a Buddhist, then write Buddhist superversive fiction. If you're a Wiccan, write Wiccan superversive fiction. Just make it superversive.
That is a fair point. And it should be your characters. And really, it's a way of saying you should have heroes that aspire to something, to the next plane of existence, I guess is a way to put it. And again, not to dump on the new pulp guys too much, but I don't see a lot of that. Most of their heroes that I've encountered are motivated purely by pride and ego and not by a desire to do something greater. And I really like that about the Superverses. And I really think that they're working on a higher level, and I like that. But that's not the kind of story that I'm writing, because this is let me back up a step. One of the reasons that I'm here, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you're this way too, is Gamergate, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this is the first time that you had a pushback against the forces of modern culture. And it wasn't just the video gamers did not just hold their ground. It was a legit pushback. They hurt the people who wanted to converge video games, who wanted all video games to serve the narrative. Mm-hmm. That wasn't an unmitigated victory. Look at Half-Life Andromeda. Is that what it is?
Mass Effect Andromeda.
Mass Effect.
But, I mean, BioWare's been going down the tubes for a long time, so.
Yeah. So, that was – and I wasn't actively engaged in it, but I was following it. And when I saw the successes there, I started looking around, because I had been kind of retreating from culture. And I said, where's my hill? You know, what am I going to do? And this is even before the Make America Great Again Trump revolution. I said, I want to get involved. And where's my hill? And I realized that as a guy that is a voracious reader, I read 100 books a year, and that's my hill to die on. I'm going to go out and I'm going to fight. And I looked for a general. And one of the things I like about the pulp revolution, we're going to get back to superversives, bear with me, is that it's – you know, they say you're the average of the five people you hang around with most. And whenever I look around the five people I hang around with most, and I'm the smartest one, I find four new people to hang around with, because I don't want to be it. You know, I should be at the bottom of that. And I feel that way with the pulp revolution. I'm constantly amazed by all of the wonderful things that these people are pointing out, and all of the things that they're reminding me that I once believed in and just kind of, you know, forgot or tabled, because you don't talk about these things in polite society. So, you know, when I found that hill, I said, okay, well, now what's my strategy? And I'm looking at the superversives, and their vision, they're looking at the higher powers, great. But that's only one front in this war. And what I like about the pulp revolution is that it's the subtle assumption of all of the things that the superversives are blatant about. It's the notion that a father who wants to protect his daughter can be torn by a desire to protect his daughter from the kind of politics of the Game of Thrones, and yet he wants to protect his country from the rampages of a dragon. How do you deal with that? You know, and his motivation, even without the actual acknowledgement of a Christian ethos, is still that kind of assumption that fathers protect their daughters. That's what they do. As you read through that whole, through the, if you buy Five Dragons, it's got the four novellas, Different Ways to Kill a Dragon, plus one short story. Every single one of those, the common thread is that they don't necessarily have to be specifically Christian, but it's just there. It's the culture that America once had of, you know, gentlemen behave like gentlemen and ladies behave like ladies. And, you know, fathers protect their daughters and priests protect their flocks. And women who are trapped in a horrible situation, you know, young women want to raise families. And a woman who is in a situation that she can't have a family will adopt one and will constantly look for ways to get out of that situation so she can get one. And you don't see that in Marvel movies. Not very often. No. You know, about the closest thing I can think of is the one point at which Hawkeye was talking to his wife about how, you know, I kind of got to go fight the aliens here with all of these demigods. And the wife is like, yeah, this kind of stinks. I don't want to lose you, but I know this is what we got to do.
Yeah, or maybe Natasha Romanoff, Black Widow, actually regretting that she was made sterile by, you know, the thing that Joss Whedon caught so much hell over and was run off Twitter over.
Exactly. And that was one of the most humanizing moments in all of those films. It was one of the most real and genuine moments. And, you know, the powers that be hated it for that reason. These are pod people. I don't know where they come from. That they can't believe that would be a motivating factor. But that made perfect sense to me. And it kept me in the movie for one more movie. And then the Civil War movie was just, oh, what a nightmare.
I haven't seen it, but, you know. I'll probably get really drunk and watch it one day. But
look, I like Marissa Tomei. Okay, I think she's a good actress. She's a very good-looking lady. She is not Aunt May. I don't understand.
That's your big gripe. That's your big gripe. Yes. Marissa Tomei is not Aunt May.
Aunt May is the look. Listen, I'm telling you, man. They are like two movies away from making Aunt May a cyborg assassin who don't need no man.
I mean, actually, if they do that as like an alternate universe movie, I might be kind of into that. That could be pretty fun.
I don't get it. I don't. And, you know, when I look back at all of these, one of these things I like to do is, you know, that you can fight all you want, but meme magic is real. You know, I've come to accept that. And there's a psychological basis for that. You know, I mean, the reason you eat at McDonald's is because the commercials are everywhere. So, you know, a lot of the things I do, I go pull old covers of pulp magazines. One of the most popular ones I threw out on Twitter was where I had a magazine with a picture of the bare-chested man saving a woman, saying, you know, in the pulp, sometimes the man saved the woman. And then the next one was a cover that had the bare-chested woman saving a man. And I said, sometimes the women save the men. And then the third one was the man and the woman kind of leaning on each other, fighting their way out of a horde of aliens. I said, sometimes they saved each other. And the whole point was that you've been lied to. The pulps are not what you think they are. You need to go back and actually experience them so you can see how wonderful, for the most part, they were. Now, granted, we're talking about a 50-year run of a dozen magazines. We're talking thousands and thousands and thousands of pages. Were there some stinkers? Oh, there were some stinkers. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, you don't judge by the worst. You should judge by the average. And until you've read a few, you have no idea how wonderful most of these were.
Actually, a good example of a story that's like precisely what you're describing there. And
let me stop you because I want to finish the point. Okay. One of the things that you notice in those pulp magazines is that the men in those magazines are actually men. You know, they are guys with crow's feet and they are guys with thinning hair, and maybe they're a little doughy, but they're actually men. And you don't see that much anymore. Most of the heroes that we see now, you know, guys have gone the ways that have gone the way of the actresses, where once you don't turn 28, because unless you can guarantee pulling $20 million at the box office like a Dwayne Johnson, then we have no use for you. You know, I looked at what was the thing? My kids were watching a show. I can't remember what it was. But it was probably some WB thing. And it was supposed to be like, I don't know, a Jekyll and Hyde or something like that. And it was a bunch of 22-year-olds. And I thought, you got to be kidding me. You got to be kidding me. What do they have, the Portrait of Dorian Gray in their closet? it was ridiculous. Anyway, I cut you off. Go ahead.
If people want to get an idea of a good pulp story that kind of encompasses what you're talking about with the whole sometimes they save each other, is At the Feet of Neptune's Queen by Abraham Strongjohn in Kirsova number 1. That story blew me away. And I keep raving about it because it's so damn good. This is probably like the third or fourth podcast that I've just raved about this story in. But it's so good. And the basic premise is what you were talking about. Like they get, these two people are about to get married. They have spent all of this time, you know, in backstory that is not really delved into, liberating their planet. And then they get sucked up to Neptune and put into this like worse than the Hunger Games style, you know, labyrinth that they have to get through and fight all of these monsters. And it's the dude and his wife and their like manservant. And they're just kicking ass and taking names. And the chick is still a woman. She's obviously feminine and, you know, she has all of these female characteristics. But at the same time, when they finally get to the arena fight, they're all kicking ass. And I'm doing my damnedest to not drop any spoilers here, but it's an amazing story. And it's exactly what you're talking about with the old school pulps. And it's another one of those things that gives me hope that the new pulps can be just as good, if not better, than the old.
Yeah, and it's I think that's true. And I don't even know if they can be better, but if they just meet it, but they're taking place in a more modern world. I obviously have no problems with the story that, you know, that acknowledges the past 75 years of history. I know the story you're talking about. That was the story that you pick up Kirsova. I was already interacting with Alex before Kirsova 1 came out, but I was skeptical because at this point, you know, I had been hurt so many times. My heart had been broken. So I just had a hard time giving it away.
How many failed Kickstarters have you seen?
Exactly. Well, not even Kickstarters. Just, oh, this looks really good. And then you're reading, you go, oh my God. Oh my God. He didn't call me in the morning. why am I so surprised? So I was hesitant with Kirsova. And then when I actually got, but I actually waited until it came out, and I bought it after it came out. And after I read that story, that was a story where I said, okay, this guy knows what he's doing. Yeah. And then I read Gift of the Odd Men, and
oh, it dear took
me
Lord.
A few minutes. I had to go have I had to lay down. I had to have a drink. I don't even drink. I had to have a cigarette. I don't smoke. But, you know, it was that, it was one of those, you know, where have you been all my life? And you could almost hear the violins and the strings and the, you know, I wanted to do the old singing, Oh Sweet Mystery of Life, At Last I Found Me, because I loved those two stories so much.
Oh, and, yeah, they were amazing.
You know, the rest is history. I want to be Sky Hernstrom when I grow up at this point. and I really do think that he's writing at that level already. My biggest complaint about Sky Hernstrom is he writes too damn slow. If I ever win the lottery, I'm going to hire him as a manservant just so that I can say, you know, you have to produce 3,000 words a day now, mister. And, you know, just at the end of the week, you got to have something for me, because I'm just so blown away by the fact that somebody has been so, I mean, I don't know how long it takes, but it's just such a natural expression of the kind of thing I grew up on.
Oh, yeah, dude.
You know, and going back to what you were talking about, the way I read books for the longest time, I can't check books out of the library because I just can't return them in time.
I have the same problem.
Massive late finds. So I discovered the used book sale, and I would go down and I would buy books for like 25, 50 cents, read them, and then give them back. Here, you can sell these again. Because it was cheaper for me to just rent them for 50 cents than to check them out for free and spend $8 on late fees. But when you do that, you know, for a long time in the right around the turn of this century, most of the books are about 30 years old. So I was finding all of this old stuff, you know, the Appendix N stuff. I read all that stuff 20, 30 years ago.
Lucky you.
Not all of it. I mean, most of it. You know, the Edgar Rice Burroughs has already consumed all that. I'd already consumed Tarzan. But then all of those books started disappearing. You had to take it for granted. And then I started getting all of the pink slime. And that was where it just kind of killed me. At one point, you could buy a bag of books for $1. It was all of the like cast-offs that they couldn't sell. So it was a big bag of books for $1. And I had such a hard time finding something worth reading that I would buy one of those. I wouldn't even look at the book. I would just reach in blindly and pull one out. Whatever it was, I would read it. Romance novel, I would read it. You know, and I mean, we're talking 30, 40 books, and just one at a time, just reading it all. And, you know, that's how desperate I was to find something new, that I was willing to just blindly read things because I had been so turned off by science fiction and fantasy.
Yeah, no, I totally understand where you're coming from with that. Like, I've told this story. I think I told this story in the podcast with Jeffro, but like it just sticks out in my mind because it's so it's kind of so poignant as to what, you know, major chain bookstores are doing now with science fiction and fantasy. Like, I went into a book. This was after I had just gotten like Appendix N, and I had just started reading it, and I was reading like Fofford and the Grey Mouser, and I hadn't even gotten to Princess of Mars at this point. But I went into a Books a Million. I want to say I think it was a Books a Million. It was Barnes and Noble. It was Barnes and Noble. I went into a Barnes and Noble. And I looked around and I looked around and I looked around, and there was nothing there that I wanted. And usually when I walk into a bookstore, I'm like a kid in a fucking candy shop, man.
Oh, yeah.
I have too much to choose from and not enough money. And I'm going around and I just cannot find anything that looks interesting. So I go up to the counter. And I'm like, hey, could you help me find something? You know, I've been looking for a while. You know, I'm wondering if you guys have any Fritz Leiber. You know, and I spelled the name out because obviously the chick behind the counter was not familiar with Fritz Leiber. And that's not like women in science fiction. It's just like the culture now. Like, nobody knows who the fuck Fritz Leiber is. So I spell out his name, and she's like, no, we can order you something. But it wasn't anything that I wanted. So I was like, all right, well, what about Robert E. Howard? And they were like, no, we don't have anything by Robert E. Howard. And I was like, all right, what about H. Rider Haggard? And they were like, who? You know, like, this was the guy who wrote King Solomon's Mines. Like, that guy's character was in one of the top grossing movies of the year with League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, like Alan Quartermain. Sean Connery played that fucking character, and you're telling me you don't have this guy's book at Barnes and Noble? So I was like, all right. Well, no, that's not entirely true. They didn't have any like specific H. Rider Haggard novels, but they did have a collection that featured H. Rider Haggard. And then I asked for Burroughs, and they were like, well, we have this collection of the John Carter stories, and that's it. Like, I go through Wikisource. That's usually where I get my public domain stuff from. When I want to figure out if a story is in public domain, I go to Wikisource and I search the author's name. And if it's in public domain, I write that down on my list. And it's like, all right, we're going to produce an audiobook of that. But, you know, I've looked at Edgar Rice Burroughs's Wikisource. There are dozens, if not hundreds, of stories on his Wikisource that are, you know, most of them, I don't know, I'd probably say about a third of them are public domain. And that includes, like, several Conan books, a couple of the Cull books, you know, and then he's got all of these different series with all of these, like, this guy was one of the most prolific short fiction writers of all time. And the only thing you can give me at Barnes & Noble of his work is a pasted together collection of the first five John Carter novels. Like, it's so frustrating to get into all of this old stuff and realize how far under and behind the bus it has been thrown. Just, like, they threw it all under the bus ran the fuck over it, and then moved on for, like, 30 fucking miles. And you've got to do some research, you've got to do some searching to find this shit now.
And it would be one thing if you're talking about the guy, the like eighth, you know, the number eight on the top 10 writers of the 1930s. But this is a number one, man. This is the peak.
Yeah, exactly. I recently read a few blog posts, like, we're talking like recently is like, you know, a month and a half, 2 months ago. But, you know, Burroughs got America literate. Like, his stories were so good and so prolific and so much fun to read. Come back to the drum that I've been banging on for a fucking year now.
Mm-hmm.
So much fun to read that the average common man would go and buy Burroughs novels and Burroughs novellas and stuff like that and magazines with Burroughs in them because he was just so much fun. And at that point in time, sci-fi and fantasy, I mean, like, correcting for markets and, you know, size and everything like that, and currency, sci-fi and fantasy was selling like gangbusters back then. It was crazy. You couldn't keep this shit on the shelves. And then, like, all of this stuff with the Campbellians and the Futurians and the New Wave and the SJWs and all of that stuff happened, and now we're like two of the lowest grossing genres on Amazon.
Oh, now hold on. I gotta stop you right there, Jim.
Oh, am I wrong about something? There. Please
you're
correct me if I'm wrong.
You're wrong about two things. It's one genre. and when you add those genres together, it's number two behind only romance.
Okay. Okay, see, I was not aware when of the adding those. I was going by how Amazon breaks it down. So, yeah, you're absolutely right about that.
I actually had a blog post on that on seagullrising.blogspot.com.
Which
that just
you should all
day.
Go read. And by the way, I've been meaning to talk to you about this just to diverge for a second.
Mm-hmm.
I know for a fact Blogspot has a widget where you can let people subscribe to your blog posts. Put that shit on your blog, dude.
Oh yeah, because
I miss so many posts because I have to go back and check out. It takes like 10 minutes.
Listen, I'll figure that. It's just one of the little widget plugins. I'll add that in sometime tonight. I tell you what though, I post every Monday, Wednesday, Friday without fail. So and most of the stuff that I post is relatively timeless. So you know, I assume people are just going to wait a week or two and then go back and read through all some of the old stuff. And you're right. You know, fundamentally, I'm not a fantastic marketer. Somebody like a week ago was yelling at me about how I need to publicize my stuff.
It might have been me.
Really good looking guy. I can't remember who, really dapper and wiser than me. So I took his advice and I agreed to do a couple of podcasts. So we'll see if that pays off.
Like, honestly, dude, if you want some really good economic advice about how to market your stuff, you should look up Aaron Clary. Like, and I know that the guy plugs me in his podcast because I did two audiobooks for him, and I plug him, but you know, right, kind of in return. But he's got a video out there called "How to Make Money as a Blogger, Podcaster, YouTuber, or whatever it is." It's got a picture of a Yeti microphone as a thumbnail. Go watch that video. It's like an hour long. He explains everything, and he goes into excruciating detail about how to monetize your online presence. And it's just like, the guy's an economist. So it's just like basic economics knowledge. But,
sure.
But it's also got strategies in it that you wouldn't necessarily think of if you didn't know that those strategies existed. So I would recommend that to anybody who's trying to monetize their online presence.
Is that C-L-A-R-Y?
E-Y. A A R O N C L A R E Y.
EY. All right. Yeah, I'll give that a look. Well, listen, I tell you, I'm in the, you know, part of my goal here is that, you know, when the pulp revolution takes off and I'm serving as have been serving as a loyal lieutenant, is to do this full time. Now, I'm actually about a year and a half into a 5-year plan that, you know, it's two pronged. I do the audiobooks for Castalia House. I just put the finishing touches on Forbidden Thoughts. So the anthology by the Superversives. So, you know, keep an eye out for that sometime in the future. I'll be turning over all the files to their audio guys. That'll be coming out pretty soon. But, you know, the writing is actually the one that I'm working on right now. And my strategy right now is get as much material producing out there as fast as possible, at least, you know, through this year. And then really start hitting the marketing when I have a bigger back catalog. Because, you know, one of the things I didn't want to do is if people really love your first book and then they got to wait 6 months, they're going to forget about you. So you're right. My marketing is terrible. And don't take my advice because, you know, you chart your own course. Listen to Aaron Clary. Listen to these other guys like the other successes. You know, don't take financial advice from a broke guy. But that's kind of how I'm doing this. And
well, I mean, it's just one of those things. Like, you see Brian Niemeyer's on top of this. Like, I
go and John DeLaRoz.
Oh yeah, him too. Also, Declan Finn. Although Declan Finn does it a little bit less skillfully than Brian Niemeyer does, but I'll just chalk that up to Niemeyer's experience. But at the same time, you know, you follow these guys on Twitter, like 5 to 10 tweets every day is just, hey, I have this novel on Amazon. You know, it wouldn't kill you to to start pimping your stuff a little bit more, you know.
Right. I'm relying on guys like you. I'm relying on word of mouth, and I really do. I appreciate all the kind words that you've sent me, and all of the signal boost. It's a big part of what we're trying to do here. And fundamentally, you know, so many of the posts that I make, either on my blog or on Twitter, are, hey, look at this other guy. Look at this other guy. I'm always pointing out people. You got to go look at this guy. You got to go read Jesse Lucas's blog. That guy's got it going on. Ogma's doing some amazing stuff.
Oh, man, I am so glad Ogma started blogging. His shit is incredible, man.
But particularly since we lost old LaHook to the Twitter meat grinder, you know, I can't tell you how much I miss seeing him bombing people.
Oh yeah, you and me both. I just like pour one out for the fallen man. Like, I know he's active on Gab and everything like that, but I went and checked his blog recently, and he hasn't posted anything in a while.
He just had a post on Castalia House's blog about Frank L. Baum that was really good.
I'll have to go check that out.
There. Yeah. Yeah. And that's a big part of, you know, and that one of the reasons I do that is that one of the weaknesses right now is that there's no central clearinghouse. I know that the Castalia House blog is making a big push to review a lot more short fiction. And I tend to agree that short fiction is where the future is, you know, with people don't have, I think that the doorstopper 10 volume epics are kind of going to go the way of the dodo. Mm-hmm. Because reading now has so many other different forms of entertainment to compete with that it's hard to find enough time to read a 700-page epic.
There's all kinds of stuff. Like, I'm a member of Writing.com, and Writing.com has, like, flash fiction and short fiction, and, like, we're talking, like, under 1,000 words short fiction and stuff like that, where they just tell people to do all of this stuff. And, you know, even authors are getting in on this. Like, some people will do, like, I hesitate to point to the creepypasta community, but sometimes they'll do videos where there's, like, you know, 5 stories in this one video, and they're all, like, 500 words long or something like that. So, yeah, short fiction is making a huge comeback. People absolutely love that stuff because it's efficient. You know, you can, you know, be on the train or the bus or whatever, and, you know, pop open your Kindle or your phone and read a 500-word story or a 1,000-word story or something on your way to work, and then, you know, you get off work and you do the same thing on the way back. You know, investing all that time in this big 10-book epic, like, I've tried to do that before, with the Sword of Truth series. I love the Sword of Truth series. I got, like, 6 books in, and I'm just like, I'm fucking tired, dude. Is this where is this going?
I hear you. The last one of those I read was L. Ron Hubbard's Battlefield, not Battlefield Earth. What was the other one? Like Invasion Earth or something. And it was one of those where, yeah, you're like six books in and you're just like, oh, God, I got to finish it now. Oh, I don't want to finish it. And he did a lot of little tricks like shifting viewpoints, character viewpoints, and, you know, the anti-hero, you stop following him, you start following the hero, but it was just, oh, God.
But then you find just, something that's like shorter and more interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, well, in particular with the delivery method that Amazon has, you can go, okay, look, that, but here's what I was getting at is there's no clearinghouse. You know, what I want to be able to do is say, okay, look, I have a dollar and I have a half an hour and I don't want to spend 25 minutes looking for something worth reading. Where do I go? And I think that's going to be the revolutionary thing. If somebody out there is smart enough to figure out how to put together a – look, Kurosawa's description of the stories that they accept are basically – Alex says, I publish the kind of stories that I want to read. It's kind of like pulp, but it doesn't have a real definition, but you don't need one, you know?
Exactly.
These days, he's publishing the Kurosawa style, and that's all we need to know. And you tell people it's kind of like, you know, it's a little bit of pulp with a little bit of new wave with a little bit of experimentation, and you do. But someday, somebody is going to put together a site where I can go, okay, look, you know, granted, I have a huge backlog right now. But what if I just have half an hour and want to try a new author that I've never tried before? Where do I go? You know, and at some point somebody's going to have – now I have on Seagull Rising, you can click on the recommendation tag and you can just kind of scroll through my posts to find things. But it would be great to have like a central Pulp Revolution clearinghouse or Superversum clearinghouse where you can go pull any one of those down. And I think once that technology matures or once we get a couple of sites like that, that's going to be Katie bar the door. Because whether you publish a 2,000 word story or 10,000 word story, you can sell that for a buck, and you know people will read that, consume it, and move on and look for the next one. And it doesn't, you know, part of the problem that the publishers have right now is that their minimum price point, you know, it costs them like $8. If they wanted to prepare a blank book and sell it, it costs $8.
That actually happened recently.
Yeah, that's a hysterical story. Do you want to tell the people at home about that?
Okay. From what I understand, this guy who's affiliated with like the Daily Wire and Ben Shapiro, and I know this because I listened to Ben Shapiro's podcast, but apparently he wrote a book called Reasons to Vote Democrat. And it's like, I want to say something like 400 blank pages. It, like the entirety, it's just blank. And Ben Shapiro's blurb on the front is thorough.
Yeah.
And the dude has become one of the top sellers on Amazon because he published a blank book called Reasons to Vote Democrat.
And that's all it takes. Yeah. Well, so the point there is now, and here's the other thing that people need to realize is that $8 price point, it doesn't matter whether the book is 200 pages or 700 pages. So when somebody goes into a bookstore and they have to spend $12 on a novel, are they going to grab the 200 or are they going to grab the 800? Well, they're going to grab the 800 because they want to get the most bang for their buck. You know, $12 is an investment. So that's why I think that's why you've seen this big push for all these huge, sweeping, epic books. And also people don't want to take risks. Oh, here's an author I like. Good. The 800-page book will be 800 pages I know I can rely on. But with a digital revolution, you can say, I got a dollar. If it sucks, I bail and I'm out pocket change. I'm not worried about it.
Yeah. You're like, you're not even up to candy bar price at that point.
Exactly. And, you know, and if it's good and I get 20 minutes enjoyment out of it, great. And if it's bad and I only get 5 minutes, then, you know, what have I really lost? Not much at all. So I really like Castella House's blogs. I like their push for doing more modern short fiction. I think that's going to pay off in the long run.
Yeah, I really do also think that is the future. I'm also kind of banking on that being the future because, like I said, I can't write a novel to save my life. But I can write a short story. I can write a lot of short stories.
I hear you. And that's the book that I'm working on right now. You know, I'm actually banking short stories to put together another collection. Because the book – oh, hey, here you go. Here, Jim, I got an exclusive for you. The book that I'm working on right now is called A Moon Full of Stars, and it starts out basically as a gamma world pastiche.
No, this is scientifically inaccurate. The moon does not have stars in it. We must burn this.
No, but it is hard science fiction because you see the stars and the moon are actually moon bases. that our Gamma World people go to. And then there's wizards and man bear pigs and stuff that's hard science fiction, but I don't care because it's on the spectrum, much like myself. So there's your exclusive. Look for it coming hopefully before the end of April, A Moon Full of Stars. But to be honest,
awesome. I will look forward to it. I still need to write up that that post about I'm drunk. Rescue Run.
Sudden Rescue is John DeLaRoz's hard game tie-in.
There you go.
And he's another guy. He needs to get his steampunk novel out because I want to read that.
Yeah, me too.
My backlog has a backlog. I've got like these are the stuff that's out that I want to read, and I already have my like this needs to be added as soon as it's available. But the point is that both of these are going to wind up being about 200 pages long by the time they're done. And a big part of that is because that's all it needs. You know, it's a space trucker and a space princess. 200 pages is enough.
Yeah,
you get
like
you tell your story, and you get out. I could easily
that's
add
like
three
Edgar
subplots.
Rice Burroughs.
Yeah. What do I need subplots for, though? I mean, that's just going to waste time. And if the subplot is good enough, I'll just turn it into a book of its own.
Yeah, I mean, you've created this universe already. There's no excuse for you to not play around in it. That's one of the reasons that I like Andrew Beery's work so much, who could actually possibly be qualified as superversive, because he's writing science fiction from a Christian perspective, and like all of the books that the first novel I ever read by this guy was the one that I recorded the audiobook for, and eventually it got to the point where it's like, oh, okay, this guy's obviously Christian. Yeah, he's trying to bring like deeper truth into science fiction. And it's gotcha. Good. It's good fiction, but he's got like the Catherine Kimbridge novels are, from what I understand, his main series. But he's also got all of these other characters, like the Marine commander of the Infinity Brigade, and the Infinity Brigade has their own series of novels. And there's like space pirates going on, and the space pirates have their own series of novels, and. You know, all of this stuff. I don't think he has audiobooks out for all of it yet. I think he's just concentrating on the Cat Kimbridge books right now. But but yeah, like there's like that's the kind of approach that you could take to it. You know, I've created this universe, and if I want to tell another story in it, then I can tell another story in it. You know,
yeah. The other thing I'm looking forward to, I haven't seen a whole lot of this, but I'm also looking forward to seeing some shared universes. You know, I'd like to see a couple of guys put together, and again, boy, I'm going to start sounding like a Misha Burnett fanboy, and if I am, I don't care. He's worth having fanboys. He was talking about – he had thrown out a proposal for a story, and somebody else said, oh, wow, that's – I might steal that. And he said, go for it. I love this. And my initial reaction was, I'm not going to do that. I got my own stuff to write. But then I started thinking about it. I was like, you know what? I got an idea that would fit great in that universe. So I got to go back and hit Misha up and just let him know, hey, I'm stealing that. Or you need to do it quick so that I know what my starting point is, because I got an idea for it. So there's these guys that they sneak onto military firing ranges, like the big bombing ranges.
Yeah.
And they sneak on and they steal the unexploded ordnance. Okay. But what if – it's and I think they kind of played with this idea a little bit in Pacific Rim with the guy that sold the body parts for the giant monsters after they died.
Oh yeah, Ron Perlman's character.
Ron Perlman's. Yeah, it's kind of like that, but if you've ever seen these guys that are wildcatting out grabbing the UXO, they're a bunch of rednecks. They're a bunch of hillbillies driving around and shagging in the back. So what I'd like to see is them sneaking into an area. Okay, so battle's over. You know, they beat the bad. You know, Godzilla killed the monster after all the ordnance didn't work, and they basically put up the radioactive signs. Well, I want to know about the rednecks that go in there trying to pick up that lost ordnance, and they run into the fleas and ticks that jumped off of
the giant monster,
the Mothra after it died. Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff there.
Oh man,
so
actually,
the shared universes in particular, with the short fiction being easy enough to do, and so many people active right now, I think by the end of the year we're going to see a couple of those where guys sit down, hash something out, and then go, okay, go explore it now.
I really, really hope so, because I've like my younger brother, he he's not the fastest writer. He barely writes at all, but he comes up with some, he's a brilliant idea man. And he has this idea about a universe that he's already got like fleshed out. Like he's spent years developing this universe, but he just has to sit down and actually write the stuff in it. Now I heard about this universe and I helped him develop it. And I actually went out and wrote like 5 stories in it. One of them is a novella. It's like, I don't know, like 75,000 words long or something like that. Which is also a love letter to Firefly. But,
75,000 words is a full blown novel.
Really?
Yeah, like.
Well, it might not be that long. I don't know. I would have to go and open the Word document, and I'm not going to bother with that shit right now because it might screw with OBS. Sure. But sure. But I've got this ridiculously long novella. I would classify it as, because I don't think it's good enough to be classified as a full blown novel, but. With this universe, it's so open to interpretation by so many people. Because the basic premise, like we could probably, like if I hammered it out and actually typed it out with him, we could probably do like a guide to writing in this universe. But the basic premise is humans are the bad guys, and that's not necessarily like any moral referendum or anything. It's just like aliens came down to Earth and they decided that, okay, you're way, way too warlike to join like the Galactic Coalition of Planets or whatever it is. So we're going to lock you in this space bubble, essentially. And nobody's ever broken out of it before. There's thousands of these running around the universe, but nobody's ever broken out of it before. And through basic human ingenuity, humans are the ones to break out of it. And then they immediately start building up their forces and go on a genocide run.
It's a nice galaxy you got here.
For the universe.
Shame if something were to happen to it.
No, I mean the entire universe, not just the galaxy, like the whole universe, like everything that is not human must die. Kind of shit. So they're like aliens thousands of light years away from Earth that are telling their children horror stories about how the humans are going to come and get them in the night if they're not if they're not good little boys and girls, you know.
So the whole series is told from the point of view of the aliens.
Well, that was one of the things that that we had talked about was like the series was going to be like a series of short stories in this world and maybe some novels if we could actually work up the gumption to write novels in this universe. But like my stories are from the perspective of humans. So like the novella that I was telling you about is about that. Like I say, it's a love letter to Firefly. So this guy kind of operates outside of the law. But if he gets a contract from EarthGov, essentially, then he'll go and carry it out because he has to. But he's really pissed off that, you know, we can't make peace with the aliens. Like, that's one of his big conflicts and everything. But there's all kinds of, you know, good action and
sure.
Crazy shit. I even throw in a fucking Futurama reference where the killbot gets a magnet attached to his fucking head. And he proceeds to just lay waste to the enemy forces while singing show tunes.
God bless. Bender is my spirit animal, by the way. When I go into my sweat lodge and start humming and do some Mongolian throat singing, it's Bender that leaps into my mind.
I absolutely love that character to death. But it was kind of meant to be this world where you could take it any way you want. Kind of like Warhammer 40K. If you want to write like an Eldar story or an Orc story or something like that from the perspective of these particular races, you could do it. And there was
then you are a Xenos sympathizer and you must be purged.
Well, yes, of course, heretics must be purged. But the whole kind of point to this was to write like the basic stories in the universe and do whatever we wanted with it, and then kind of open it up to other people and, you know, see what they came up with. Because you can write from alien perspectives, you can write from human perspectives. Like, I took the human perspective that was not necessarily amenable to the human agenda. Sure. But it's just one of those things. Like, we'll have to like come together and actually, now that I've mentioned it on the fucking podcast, we'll have to actually like come together and write up some rules for writing in this universe. Cause there is a basic structure to how things went down and like a timeline and stuff like that. But you know, apart from that, it's basically do whatever the fuck you want with this. Like, you can go buck wild. Just the humans have to be the genocidal crazy people.
Yeah, and that's really one of the areas where I've been a little bit slow on the uptake, is that when you do anthologies like that, when you put your name next to phenomenal writers like Brian K. Lowe, his Invisible City book is fantastic. It's the closest thing I've read to an Edgar Rice Burroughs novel. Or, you know, if you get into a Kurosawa, then you get your name out there. You might not make a lot of money publishing at semi-pro zine rates, but that's going to drive traffic to the other stuff that you are putting up. And so, you know, anybody that's out there that's kind of sitting on the fence about whether to submit to any of these collections, I say go for it.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You won't make a lot of money, but if you're just starting, you're not making any money anyway. So absolutely go for it. Get your name out there and try to have a few things that are paid. And I'll tell you, one of the things so Five Dragons is the first like real book length title that I released. And what I did is I wrote, you know, you don't have to start with Game of Thrones. I wrote a 20,000 word novella just to see if I could do it. That was King's Dragon. And I could, and it was fun. So I wrote and I put it up for a buck. Nobody had heard of me at that point, you know, so take a risk. And then I wrote another one, 20,000 words, and I put it up for a buck. And I specifically set out with the goal that I need to write 4 novellas. Now that's 80,000 words. And you sell each one of those for $1. And after you have all 4 together, then you can put them together as a collection. And now now you've got 80,000 words. But you didn't have to write start to finish 80,000 words. You can kind of cobble it all together. And now you've got a collection of your own. And what I, in my case, I wrote like a 6,000 word short story from the point of view of a dragon to accompany it. And by the way, if you read Five Dragons, one of the things you'll notice is that there's 4 novellas. And in the first one, the main character is the fighter. And in the second one, the main character is the thief. And in the third one, the main character is the wizard. And in the fourth one, I think you all see where this is going, right? So it's kind of theme and variation, and then, you know, you mix things up a little bit. But the reason I did that is if you enjoy the first one, okay, you know, it's got a knockdown, drag-out fight with the dragon and the fighter. And then you read the second one. And, you know, in the first one, the dragon is a force of nature. It's just a big, dumb lizard. That's all you need. In the second one, he is a cunning and clever guy that can't be beat by beating him over the head with a sword. He has to be defeated through trickery. And then, likewise, the third one, you got to be smart to beat this guy. You got to come up with a clever plan. And the fourth one is a demonic dragon. So you got 4 different variations of a demon. And, of course, the only way to beat a demon is to have a very strong faith. The protagonist, who's the priest, struggles with that a little bit. You'll see when you read it, of course.
When. That is a when. I am planning on reading all of this.
You know, again, the advice here is that I think your plan to write a series of short stories is great. If it's 5,000 to 10,000 words, put it up for a buck. Just as they come out, put it up for a buck. And then when you have enough to justify a $3 to $5 purchase for the collection, then you can sell it that way. That's honestly, kind of thing I see moving forward.
Honestly, the way that I write stories is that, like, there's an obvious progression. Like, I've got one story about a monster hunter that was inspired by an episode of it was either Pseudopod or Nightmare Magazine, but they had this story out about this family who had been tasked to hunt fairies. Like that was their thing, and they transformed. They like got like black claws and black teeth and shit. It was just black claws. But eventually, fairies kind of wandered out of the world. Like, I'm giving you the like drunkest synopsis possible of this, but fairies had faded out of the world.
The fantasy version.
Yeah, basically. But fairies had kind of faded out of the world, and they couldn't. the power that they had made them go insane. Like, eventually the children would transform and just kill people because they didn't have any fairies to take their aggression out on.
Okay.
So they would strap them down to a table and they would knock their teeth out. Now that I remember it, their teeth transformed as well. But they would knock all their teeth out and they would cut their fingers off at the first knuckle. They would just strap these kids down at like age of like puberty. Like when they started hitting puberty and they started showing signs, they would just chain them to a table and take some bolt cutters and cut their fingers off and knock their fucking teeth out. And that would kind of fix the problem. Honestly, it's a decent story, but I wanted to read the story about when these people were like running around fighting fairies.
Yeah.
You know, so I decided that was a good enough premise to go in.
You're burying the lead here, people. Come on. This is not where you start.
Yeah, and it was kind of one of those, like it only happened to women or the firstborn or whatever it was. Like, the main character was a woman in the story, okay. And, you know, you can kind of see the ideological bias creeping in here. But I decided that I wanted to read the story about the people who could transform when they got near fairies running around fucking up fairies. So yeah. I decided to go and write that story. And I've got one story, the first story in the series that I submitted to Misha Burnett's thing and got rejected, but I understand why. No bad blood. The very next story, and a lot of these stories are honestly inspired by Dio lyrics. Like, honestly, if you want really good fantasy inspiration,
you gotta help me out here. Dio.
Ronnie James Dio. He sang for Elf and then Rainbow and then Black Sabbath, and then he went on and did his own solo thing. Ronnie James Dio. He's like one of the metal gods out there. He's like one of the biggest guys in metal. But his albums Master of the Moon and Killing the Dragon, a lot of the songs in those albums tell stories, and the stories that they tell are very inspiring. And I took a couple of these ideas. Like there's one song, I believe it's on Master of the Moon, that's the Gypsy Queen, I think is the name of the song, but I'm probably just remembering the chorus. But I took that and I was like, okay, well, what if there's this character from, you know, the age where fairies are running around and fucking shit up, and these people are like tasked by the gods to transform and get all of these superpowers and then kill fairies. And what if he has to deal with this very human conflict with this gypsy queen who is fucking with this ranger? Because
it's all allegory because you're a gay basher. I'm on to you.
Yeah, definitely. It's totally. You've seen through the curtain. But the first story ends with the guy convalescing after his fight with this fae creature. And he meets this other character who I've taken a note from the Superversives here. And she is a servant of God, and she can't get into all of the sexual shit that this guy usually gets. Like, this guy is a frequent visitor of whorehouses. But she is very pretty while at the same time being very chaste. But she decides that this guy is obviously going to fucking die if he doesn't have a healer around with him to help him recover from these fights that he apparently gets into all the goddamn time. So she just comes along for the ride, and that's where the second story picks up. He's like on the road and he's trying to figure out how to get rid of this girl, because if she stays around with him, she's gonna get attacked. She's going to die. Somebody's going to try to take her life, and it's gonna be his fault because she thought he was her responsibility.
There you go. Hey, listen, you know Carl Gallagher's Torchship is very much in that vein. That book is actually a string of about five short stories that have been kind of jammed together seamlessly, mind you. But it's, you know, it's they're a tramp freighter, and they go to the one planet and have an adventure, and then they have to haul this and they have an adventure. And there's a couple of like overarching plots. So it's kind of like a lot of the TV shows do these days, where you can read chunks of the book as standalone adventures, but there's these threads that unite them all together, and it's done really well. And that may be another way to go, is, you know, just a couple of vignettes between them, and boom, you got yourself a novel, man.
Yeah, I mean, like I was saying, I write a story, and then I want to follow these characters throughout all of their adventures. So, the way that I write stories is very, very freaky. Like, it's more like channeling than what most people would consider writing.
It's freaky, but... huh? I'm detecting a theme here, Jim. Freaky?
Yeah. I don't know. I have all of these little crazy fucking rules. I can't fuck with the way that a story progresses, but, you know... I can try to make it sound better, essentially. Sure. Like the dialogue is all the dialogue. Like, I've had dialogue that comes out of literally fucking nowhere, and it makes no sense. But that's what that character said right there, and okay. I can't really change it. So I write stories weird. I'd probably be an editor's fucking nightmare. But I want to follow these characters all the way through their adventures. So I'll write this one story about like how these characters meet. And then, you know, we'll pick up like 2 weeks later, and then we'll write that story. And then we'll pick up like, I don't know, two or three or a month later, you know, and we'll write that story, and we'll find out where these characters go. So I can't write a novel, but I can write a lot of vignettes that could be tied into a novel. So I don't know. I'm just fucking weird like that. But no, I totally get what you're saying, and that's an absolutely valid way to market your stuff or to publish your stuff, is that you'll write what you can, and then you get what you can out, and then once you get what you can in this self-contained timeline out, then you can publish it all as like an anthology collection, and then you can, you know, let the people who want to pay for the individual stories pay for the individual stories, and then you can sell the novel as well.
And this isn't exactly news. I mean, this is kind of how Fafford and the Grey Mouser stories went. You know,
most
of the collections that came out in the 70s were just stories that were ripped out of, you know, or they were serialized first in the pulps, and then somebody said, okay, time to, you know, now that's cheap enough, let's slap them in a book and charge $5 for the whole collection.
Yeah, definitely. Like, honestly, that's one of the big problems that people have with the first Fafford and the Grey Mouser novel, is that there's not enough adventure going on in this thing. You know, they don't really meet each other for the first like half of the fucking book. And yeah, that's a valid criticism. But at the same time, like I had this problem when I reviewed it. I didn't know that this, like, it flowed so seamlessly that I didn't understand that this wasn't a novel.
Sure.
So, like, that's a way that you can run your stuff. But if you're more if you're more into writing novels, then go write novels. You know, you know, have fun.
Yeah.
Who are we to tell you how to do your thing?
Well, really, what I'm doing is talking to the people that are out there and are sitting on the fence, and just letting them know that you don't have to invest a year of time and racking your brains out and struggling to put together. You know, if you can sit down and write 1,000 words, and you do that for 1 week, five nights in a row, you got a 5,000-word story. Throw it up on Amazon. Tell them about it.
Why not?
So I mean, can go read your 5,000-word story. I'll give you a buck for it. It's worth it for me to have a buck. And you know, this kind of thing snowballs. And we're in the nascent stages of a revolution here. And get on board now, because it's getting big. It's going to get big. So get out there and do this thing. You don't need to be the next. You don't want to be the next George R. R. Martin. Believe me.
More to the point, you don't want to be.
Diabetes is not your friend. Exactly.
You don't want to be.
I'll take the money, but
I've seen interviews. I've seen interviews with like George R. R. Martin and Stephen King. Like, Stephen King is one of the most prolific writers ever. He just, he writes. That's his fucking job. Like, he wakes up in the morning, he gets his grits and eggs, and he his coffee, and he eats his shit, and then he goes to his fucking typewriter or his computer, and he writes. That's his job. George R.R. Martin is in this interview with Stephen King, and he's like, how do you do it? You know, I write, like, I want to say something like 6,000 words in 3 months. And I think, well, that's a pretty good amount. You know, don't you ever get tired? And Stephen King's like, no. And that's the big fucking difference right there, is that George R.R. Martin is not devoted to his craft. Like, every time I hear news about George R.R. Martin, it's always about some other shit he's doing rather than working on Game of Thrones. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, he's out dicking around in his yard in one of those inflatable, like, globes and shit. Or he's or he's publishing, like, old Venus and old Mars or something like that. He's not working on Game of Thrones. And then I saw him actually fucking admit to getting, like, 6,000 words out in 3 months. And I'm just like, you fucking hack! You, absolute piece of shit!
And then you see David J. West, who's like, yeah, I did 12,000 words today. That's not a record. And you kind of rub your eyes and go, ooh, well like,
holy
done,
holy shit,
man.
Dude.
Well
do you done. Just sit at your computer all day?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've approached that. I mean, I've had a couple of days where I did 10,000 words, but it was there was nothing but sitting there staring at a computer. I think I might have gotten up to go use the restroom once, and at some point I probably shoved some sustenance in my face hole, but otherwise it was just staring at the screen and just hammer. So God, but I don't know how long that's sustainable too. I mean, at a certain point, you know, people say, I again, just talking to the listeners here, if you can get 500 words a night, that's 180,000 words a year. Okay, that's two novels or nine novellas, just spend an hour a night, and even if you throw half of it away, you're still getting four or five novellas out every year, so it's doable. And this is the thing that astonishes me is, you know, these guys, if you've made enough money that you're now a professional writer and you don't have to get up and go to your day job and fight with your contractor to not do lousy quality work and fight with your client that, oh, it's fine, even though you know it's really not fine. All you got to do is write, then I can't believe you can't produce 2,000-3,000 words a day. I don't understand it. But
yeah.
But again, one of the things I like about the Pulp Revolution is that, you know, we have got a ferocious amount of high energy people. People that are out there doing all kinds of things. You're doing your writing, you're doing the podcast, you're doing the audio recording. I don't know where you find the time to do it. I don't know where I find the time to do it. You know, I got blogs right before right now that I'll admit to.
Hang on. Go back. We got a little bit of interference. Could you go back two steps?
Yeah. You know, I mean, between the three blogs that I'm writing for and the audiobooks and, you know, what else am I doing? The day job, I got a family, got all that stuff, and I'm still churning out at least 1,000 words a day. Come on there, people. You're a professional writer. Sit down and write.
And that really is the thing that we need to drive home, I think. And I need to take this advice to heart, too, because I don't – like, I kind of wait for the muse to strike, and then, you know, I'm set in front of my computer for fucking 7 hours. But – you know, you need to get into the habit of writing. Writing is a muscle. It's just like anything else. If you train it, it's going to get stronger. And even if you write the way that I do, where you're reliant on the muse, like the way that I kind of view writing is like I'm channeling. You know, I'm not creating the things that are going on. I'm witnessing events and then I am writing them down to the best of my ability. That's the way I view writing. But even if you're taking that approach to it, you can get to the place where you're able to channel better and on command. Mm-hmm. So if you just sit down and you train yourself, and this is something that I have a serious problem with, so I'm no person to be talking shit at this moment, but I'm going to keep going because why not? If you train that writing muscle, then you will eventually get to the point where you can just sit down at your computer like, okay, I got 20 minutes before I can, before I have to go to work, you know, boom, 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 boom. You know, you got 200 words or whatever, and then you just go to work. Now, some people like me get incredibly frustrated because they're not at their fucking writing desk. And, you know, they just languish all day, which is why I kind of wait for when I have a good 7 hours there and I can just write. But if you train that muscle, then you can tap into that flow and tap out of it whenever you want. And
it's my commute these days. I even turn off the radio because I'm writing in my head and I'm plotting and I'm figuring out, I'm going over what I wrote that morning, that like you said, that 200-300 words. And I think, you know what, that doesn't make any sense. I need to go back and she needs to say this instead. And I just wrote a scene. How do I go back earlier in the book and presage that? You know, how do I drop a few hints about that's where we're headed? You know, it just kind of becomes a part of who you are. And I love, like I said earlier, I love the discussions. I love talking about all the books that we've read. I love talking about the theory. But you know, at some point, we need to start showing people how it's done. And really, the best sale, you know, success sells itself. Once we get a few, you know, big successful writers, then I think you're going to see a lot more imitation.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Absolutely. As soon as we get a couple of people that really blow up, and I'm not even talking about blowing up like, you know, to the level of Larry Correa. Just blowing up to the point where Castalia House is like, this is our most successful story. What the fuck?
Right.
You know, as soon as we get a couple of people like that to spread the zeitgeist around. Like, honestly, I think that one of the big triumphs that we've had is Brian Niemeyer selling the audio rights for the Soul Cycle to Castalia House.
Yep.
Because the writing in the Soul Cycle is so good. So good.
Yeah.
And when it comes across in audio, which I'm with a few of my friends, so I might actually get to do that book. But
that would be fantastic. I'd love to hear that.
If you could put in a good word for me.
I have been. Make no mistake. You have been discussed around the Castalia House water cooler.
I've
used every ounce of my not power whatsoever. But you've got fans that are pushing for you, man.
That is much appreciated. Much appreciated. I'm very humbled by that. But like once that comes out, it's going to be undeniable because there have been fans of Brian Niemeyer that have been clamoring for an audiobook for a long time now. And like I said, I think that's going to be one of the big watershed moments when that, which is why I really want to do that. I'm even willing to get the deal with Castalia House that you have to be willing to do that book, just because I want to do that book for so damn badly. But I think that's going to be one of the big watershed moments, because audiobooks really are rising as a medium of telling stories. And, you know, there's a lot to be said for Amazon sales and, you know, even to an extent, TradPub. But once we get that audiobook out, as many fans as Brian already has, it's just going to be undeniable. And then it's going to create, like Jeffro's book did, it's going to generate this insane buzz. You know, people are going to be like, oh, you should listen to this. Or they're going to gift it to their friends or something like that. And it's just going to organically grow.
And then they're going to start looking around going, okay, where can I find something that's like this? And
exactly.
To be able to say, go check out this Sword and Flower by this guy named Rawl, because it's got that same kind of, it's almost anime, but it kind of goes off in its own direction. Then, you know, that's, I couldn't agree more. I think you're right on that one.
Yeah, so I really can't, even if I don't get to do it, which, like I said, I've been gunning for that one for months. You know, I've been really trying. Like, that was I was honestly really disappointed when he announced that he had sold the audio rights to Castalia House. But at the same time, that just means I've got to be the best. So,
well, I was gunning for Jeff Rowe's Appendix N.
I heard about that.
But it didn't work. Which
wasn't you?
Nope.
Oh man, like yeah. I had been talking to Jeffro about that, and he was like, you know, I had mentioned you as the guy who should do Appendix N, and I was like, holy fuck, Jeffro recommended me. But then they said that they had given it to their regular audio guy, and I know that you do audiobooks for Castalia House, and I thought that they had meant you, and I was like, well, you know, I didn't get to do it. I really wanted to do it, but at least my buddy got this awesome fucking thing. And now I find out that all of my dreams have been crushed yet again.
Well, listen, I know these guys. They're whoever they found is going to do a bang up job, and it'll be I have no doubt that it's going to rest comfortably within your collection.
Oh no, I have no doubts as well. Like Castalia House, that's one of the things that I really love about Castalia House is that they publish quality. Sorry, I got a little bit of the hiccups. They publish quality. I have never bought a Castalia House ebook and had problems with it.
You know, I tell you, I didn't much care for the one that Fenris Wolf did?
I'm not really sure.
The rock music one. But most of that is because I'm not a music guy. So, I'm getting a contact high apparently.
I have that effect on people.
most of the jokes kind of went over my head, and just the whole scene, I just wasn't into it. It had nothing to do with the quality of the book. It's just one of those, you know, if you're not into romance novels, you're not going to like a romance novel, and I'm just not into the music scene. Yeah. Now, that said, what's hysterical is that most of the Pulp Revolution guys, you, Kersova, Sky Hernstrom, these guys, they're constantly talking about music, and I really love when they do that. Because it's a glimpse into a world that I'm not a part of. And it's really neat to see people start talking about a world like that with the amount of passion that you guys bring to it. Because it almost makes me wish that I was a music guy and that I had time to start kind of digging into that stuff. You know, I'm reading.
We'll turn you one day.
Yeah, well, you know, the music scene is kind of like comic books for me, where I just don't have the time or the money to do it, but I'm interested enough that I wind up reading a lot about it just because the people I hang out with are into it. And when they say things like Dio, see, now I'm going to know who that is because you told me earlier. Now the next time somebody else drops that reference, I'll be like, oh, yeah, that guy that Dio and Jimbo told me about. Cool, cool, cool. I know that. So keep doing that. Sometimes people apologize, and I'm like, would you shut up about apologizing for being interested in things? You know, it's I like you, and I'm interested in what you're interested in. So just do it. Stop apologizing.
Okay, so what I'm getting from this is that I should start doing music posts on my blog.
Music all the time. That's No. But yeah, absolutely do a music post from time to time. I mean, you're an interesting guy, and look, if you wrote
that's very flattering, pants, by the way.
If your writing was pants, I would never go to your blog because there would be no reason to. But your writing is not pants. You have a way of making things interesting, even, and that's one of the things that I say in a lot of the reviews I do. I say, look, I'm not interested in this thing that he's writing about, and I really enjoyed this story. That's really the highest praise that you can pay to somebody, isn't it? I mean, it's easy to write a blog post. It's easy to write a blog post that music lovers enjoy because you're writing about something they already enjoy. But if you write a music post that a soulless person like me enjoys, now you're really shooting for a high bar. You know, now you're
selling yourself a little bit short there. Just saying.
Well, you know, it's. How do you think I got to be such a good writer? I had to choose between writing and myself. I met a man on the crossroads.
Had a dobro in his hand.
That's right. He said, hey, You wanna become successful selling stories for a dollar a pop? And I was like, shh, I'm not using this thing anyway. Yeah, here you go. Someday I'll get my soul's worth out of that guy.
Someday. Don't worry. Right. It'll happen.
It's not that far off. Like I said, it's a 5-year plan. It'll happen. I'll have my little writing studio out in the backyard. There you go. I think good times are coming, man. Get up. If you're sitting on the fence, hop on board that train now so you can say you were there at the beginning. Once Jim is commanding thousands and tens of thousands, once it's $40,000 to have him record your book because it's a guaranteed smash, you're going to want to say, hey, remember when I helped you when you were first starting out, Jim? And then he'll owe you a solid. That's what you got to get in now, people. I'm telling you.
Hey, I would say the exact same thing about you. And I'm not just, you know, sucking your dick because you're on my podcast. But like you honestly have a voice for audiobooks. Like you've got one of those voices that I wish I had. Like sitting here talking and getting drunk and bullshitting on the podcast and everything. Like my voice really isn't that impressive. You sound great.
Well, thank you.
So
thank you. I appreciate that.
Like you really don't have to like do a whole lot of like changing to your shit. Like this is the normal way I talk. When I go into a recording audiobook, I talk a lot more like this for the pros and stuff. Like I have to put in a lot of work to maintain that voice and everything like that. You've just got kind of this natural flow to your voice that's just incredible.
But, you know, everybody does. One of the things that your listeners might not understand is that when you read an audiobook, and here's what you do. Go on LibriVox, and I'm having about a 50-50 success rate of people that know how to do it and people that don't.
LibriVox.
You know, it's a performance. It's, you know, you're putting on a one-man play. And like you, I try to do voices. I try to give the impression of characters. Not necessarily, you know, I'm not Rich Little here. I'm not trying to give you a full-blown character. But, you know, I tell you, if you want to hear somebody that's operating at the top of his game, go listen to The Martian Andy Weir is the author. I off the top of my head, I should have known this because I knew I was going to bring this guy up. I don't know the name of the guy that reads it. He's phenomenal. He does accents. He does like one of the things I struggle with is women.
Buddy.
Dude, you know, I am just this fountain of testosterone. I just have so much coursing through my blood that the Red Cross is like, all right, we only give this to a man because we don't want to give your donation to a woman. You know, she'll grow a beard. That's how much testosterone I have coursing through me. And then, so to say, okay, now do a feminine character. I kind of, it's like, okay, you know, slow down a little bit. You get a little higher. In Forbidden Thoughts, there's a story that is almost all women. There's like 12 women voices. And I'm like,
oh, dear God.
I got two. I got the like high pitched and the low pitched woman.
No, I'm the exact same fucking way, dude. High pitched woman. Like I do this in my Catherine Kimbridge novels. I got like the high pitched woman and then like the sultry voice. And then that's like the only two female accents I can do.
Right. And so, you know, at that point you're like, you know, and I think the listeners they get that, you know. To where it's like, okay, so this one's going to be the fat lady and this one's going to be the old lady and I'll just talk like my grandma and hopefully it works out. You be the judge. And it's – who wrote that one? It's by – I think that's an El Jaji Lamplighter who has a great name. I love El Jaji Lamplighter's name. I always want to say it with a French accent, you know. Was it Jaji?
Yeah, no, definitely. I totally get it. She has such a cool name.
So there is more that goes into it. And a lot of, you know, just – I'm not telling you anything you don't know. This is more talking to the audience. One of the things that you have to do is to really convey the mood of the piece is, you know, you have to vary how you speak. There are times where, you know, someone is very thoughtful and they're very contemplative. And so you slow down a little more when you're doing it. And then when there's a fist fight, you got to speed up because things are happening really fast and they're moving really quick. And so, you know, as you listen to these things, that's one of the things, if you like knowing how the sausage is made, that's something to listen to. And that's one of the criteria that you can use to identify, well, does this guy know what he's doing? You know, when you hear Jim, you'll hear him using all these tricks. Whereas when you just grab something from LibriVox, this guy, I tried listening. I need to read Lord Dunsany. I downloaded Lord Dunsany and I was like really digging the words, but every single sentence the guy read was exactly the same as the sentence before.
This is one of the biggest problems that I have with Skyboat Media. That's why I'm really actually, if you're going to be at StokerCon this year, there will be a Dimension Bucket dealer table there where you'll be able to go and buy some of our books and, you know, meet Connor and Chris and stuff like that. But I'm really, really glad that I decided to refrain from being flown out to California to go attend StokerCon with my friends, because Skyboat Media has a table at StokerCon, and it would have been 3 fucking straight days of my ass meme mugging Stefan Rudnicki and his female counterpart. I don't remember her name right now, but it, just like, I'm so fucking angry listening to these people. Like I used to listen to them a lot on like Nightmare and Lightspeed and podcasts, the podcast that Skyboat Media puts out, because they do the exact same fucking voice the entire time. They never try voice acting ever. Both of these fucking people, the man and the woman, they never try voice acting. They never try to differentiate their performance in any fucking way. It's just they get up there and like, I'm the person with the voice, so I'm going to read this in my voice and you know, just kind of get by on that. And it's, you lazy son of a bitch, you make more in a year than I do in like 5 fucking years. You're telling me that you can't go and get a fucking voice acting class? You're can't fucking try to at
the
least
ridiculous thing is
get
you
the
don't
fucking
need to
mouth
be
noises
Hank Azaria
out of your shit?
You don't need to be Hank Azaria. You don't need to be Harry Shearer. You don't need like 14 fully realized developed voices for each. The author is telling people who's talking just a little higher, a little lower, a little faster, a little slower. It's not hard to just alter. Just that little bit is all that you really need.
Yeah, and I mean, if you're a fan of reading fiction, it's a lot easier to kind of differentiate between those moments. Like, I've had a lot of people, like Justin Knight is a good example. He came to me and he wanted me to, like, read this thing for his book and do an audition. And, you know, I did the audition and I sent it off and he was like, oh my God, this is amazing. You know, I let my daughter hear it and she absolutely loved it. And, you know, I'm just so impressed by what you did. It's like, I just kind of read the words that were on the screen, man. This is the mood that felt appropriate at the time. Meanwhile, you get someone like Stefan Rudnicki, who's like, you know, I'm going to read
you gotta wonder what it's like. Do these people have kids? You know, do they read stories to their kids? You know,
well, I mean,
does the cat in the hat sound
kids
exactly like Green Eggs and Ham?
I mean, I don't have kids, so that I wouldn't put that as a you know, a benchmark or anything like that. But like my perspective is like, when you're telling a story, you should at least try to differentiate between the characters, especially if the only thing that people have to go on is your voice. Because I've listened to so many audiobooks where they don't try to differentiate between the characters, and it's so hard to follow. Like, I have to catch up like 2 to 3 seconds after they've read the line. It's like, oh, this is read by, this is this other character talking, this isn't the main character talking, or something like that.
Yeah, you know, if you have 3 people in a conversation, then, you know, they don't always start with then Joe said, then Jane said, then Bill said.
Like, honestly, some of the best audiobooks, like, if you want to get into voice acting and you're looking for some good examples, the best examples that I can give you is the Witcher audiobooks. And I know we talked shit about the Witcher earlier, but the audiobooks are fucking phenomenal. Peter Kenny Peter Kenny does an amazing job with those. And the Metro 2033 audiobooks. The guy they got to record, he's like British. And he reads all of the prose in his normal accent. It's just, you know, it honestly sounds kind of posh. But then he gets into the character dialogue and he starts speaking with a Russian accent. And shit gets flipped completely on its fucking head, and you can't believe this is the same person who's reading you the prose. Very talented guy. I wish I remembered his name. But yeah, if you're looking to get into audiobooks, I would recommend the Witcher audiobooks and the Metro 2033 audiobooks. Also, Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser. Those audiobooks are really, really well done. But that's kind of a good idea of what we're talking about here with differentiating the prose and the characters and the different characters between each other.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Yep.
Sorry, I didn't mean to run roughshod and take over the whole damn thing.
No, not at all, man. Not at all. You know what you're talking about. You know what you're talking about. I just enjoy standing back and watching a master work, Jim.
I honestly could say that.
I don't know why you're laughing. Well, I was being genuine. I was being serious. I even used my audiobook voice to make it more believable.
I take compliments very badly. I don't believe I'm worth complimenting.
That's your problem with the revolution right there. That's what we got to watch out for, is people getting too big for their britches, you know? We just got to make sure to keep people humble.
Once we're all living
in our mansions, and once we're making enough money that we're going to have a pulp revolution con where we get to keep the keep the nerds out and decide who the cool kids are, and we're going to make our statue called the Jeffro.
When we become games cool journalism.
Exactly. That's something I don't see happening. It's not everybody's like, oh, you're just another clique. I don't see it that way. I see the pulp revolution as building a culture, and you know, saying that, well, you can't be pulp revolution is kind of like saying, well, you can't be into fitness. No, you know what? You like the pulps. You like the kind of the ethos of the pulps, and you like that style of writing. Come on in. It's a huge pool. There's always room for you. You come in, you want to dip your toe in for a year or two, and then you get bored of it, so you wander away? That's fine. And you want to come in, you want to take it over? Good luck. Good luck. We're all just going to wander away and ignore you. We've kind of gotten into this
fourth generation warfare. Like you brought this up in a conversation that we had previously about like people coming in and kind of monopolizing on the pulp revolution. We learned from Gamergate. You know, we're into this fourth generation warfare bullshit. If you come in here and you try to say, I am the pulp revolution, well, like, even if Jeffro came in and said, I am the pulp revolution, all of these people out here who have been doing shit and blogging and writing, it's like, okay, motherfucker, you need to calm down. You know, like, I think that's how it would start, but if he kept on with that bullshit, it would just be, like, one of those things where, okay, Jeffro gets cut out, and, you know, he's gotten too full of himself, he's tried to, you know, take control of the whole thing, fine, you know, you can go and do whatever you want on the Castelli House blog and your own blog, we'll be over here doing our thing. So I'm not, just to be clear here, I'm not trying to talk shit about Jeffro. That's a situation. No. I love Jeffro to death. So that's just a situation.
Yeah, you know, if some established author comes in and is like, hey, you know, I've sold 50,000 books, so you should listen to me about how this is how you're going to write the books, and it doesn't hold water. We're going to laugh at him, and everybody's just going to ignore him. But I tell you what, there have been a couple of guys that have come in and who have pointed out things and pointed out weaknesses in the arguments and have kind of shifted the culture. You know, not huge, not like, oh, we're going to abandon, you know, writers from the 40s or 50s or whatever. But just, hey, you know, you guys need to ease up on the new wave. There's a guy, Kevin Winkless, who I've had a lot of conversations with on G+. Who's really smart and has said, hey, you know, you need to be aware that what you're saying isn't exactly true. I I'd been shooting my mouth off about some of the Futurians, and he said, no, that's not, you know, he changed. And the other guy is Misha Dreamboat Burnett. I keep mentioning him. I just read Cat Skinner's book, okay? And I'm working with a guy. So if I mention him a lot, that's why. Also, because he's awesome and you need to go read more of his stuff. But, you know, he's pointed out, he said, look, I'm not really a Pulp Revolution guy. I really consider myself more of a New Wave guy. In fact, he won't use the term Pulp Revolution. I think if you held him down and, like literally set fire to his feet, he would still call it the Pulp Revival. And that's what I mean by it's a culture, is that these guys have been welcomed and embraced with both arms, because they're coming at us with a sense of goodwill and shared goal for improving the fiction that we're seeing, and their arguments hold water, and so they've moderated us somewhat, but they're not concerned trolls. I've seen a couple of people that have said, I don't think I like the tone you're taking here, guys, and everybody goes, whatever.
Yeah. Well.
Anyway, as I was saying, there's no such thing as hard-fired fiction.
Yeah. Well, fuck you. You can go off and do your own thing. You have your own blog, don't you? Go write your concerns over there.
Well, not even that, because they're fair. I'm not going to mention any names, because, you know, I like these people, but you know, they're a little concerned that, oh, we're getting too war garble, and everybody goes, okay, thank you. We really appreciate your input. Now, there's no such thing as hard science fiction, as I was saying. So I don't see I don't see how anyone's going to be able to take this over. Those of you that are worried about, well, what if a big author comes in and brings like 20,000 fans, and then say, you mean they're telling 20,000 people about my stuff? Sign me up for that kind of takeover, because it's not going to change the books I'm writing.
Yeah, seriously, like it's very, very individualistic. The Pulp Revolution has this kind of ethos to it, where it's like we're all out here to do our own thing, like to kind of slightly lampoon what Anthony M was saying in one of the Superversive posts. Write what you want. Write what you want. That is the ethos of the Pulp Revolution. Yes, like he was kind of being facetious there when he was talking that shit. But yes, write what you want. Write whatever you want. If you want to write feminist FSF, then write feminist FSF. If you want to write hard science fiction or hard fantasy, write that. Write whatever you want. And I think that's one of the most important drums that we can be beating right now, is write literally whatever the fuck you want, because that inures us against this kind of hostile takeover that you're describing. You know, if we have this entire group of people out here that's like, okay, we have a clique. We have a certain number of people that are respected voices in the community, or we have a few people that we respect and, you know, we take their opinions into account. But at the same time, we're all individuals and we will write whatever the fuck we want. And if you don't like that, then you can go sit and spin. You know, having that ethos to the Pulp Revolution, I think, is one of its greatest strengths.
Because... Well, and I would also point out that we say that because we are confident enough in our own abilities to tell the stories we want to tell, and that the stories we want to tell are adequately reflective of the human experience as it is in the real world, not as we would like it to be in a fancy made-up world that can come true if we only believe in fairies hard enough and just read only what I'm writing and turn over the daily decisions of our lives to some benevolent council that seriously won't starve 30 million of us to death for political reasons. You know, I think our stuff is going
to be real. You've been reading my posts about communists, haven't you?
And I've been responding to people shocked and appalled about jokes about throwing people out of helicopters. And my response is, well, first of all, just the notion of throwing people out of helicopters. Well, excuse me. I do not want to see a single human being thrown out of a helicopter. I just want to see communists thrown out of helicopters.
Yeah, same.
And there's a reason for that, because, you know.
Because communists are worse than Nazis.
Exactly. Well, they have a worse track record. I'm not saying they're worse. I'm just saying that, you know, as far as the final tally is concerned, because they were more successful, they have a higher count. You know, you look at the three highest body counts, and the only reason Pol Pot isn't, you know, number one on that list is because Cambodia was too small.
Yeah, pretty much.
So, you know, it's you're right. But the point is, going back to less
political, you know, topics.
Political topics. This is a geek gab. I can talk about politics all I want. Eat your heart out, Daddy War Pig. I'm going to throw – anyway.
If you want to go on, like, I'm literally on my last cigarette. So if you want to go on more, then you're going to have to wait like 15 minutes for me to run to the gas station and get another peck of smokes. But if you want, we can totally do that.
Listen, the point is, the works that we are writing are reflective of the human experience as it is. They touch people on a deeper level than the kind of feminist fiction, the kind of wishful thinking. Yes. My stories have wizards and ray guns and faster than light travel. But, you know, at their core, they are about human relationships as they are. They are about fathers scared for their daughters. They are about young women who just want to live a peaceful life with a family and raise a lot of kids. They are about a trucker who meets the woman of his dreams and just wants to settle down with her. That's what it's all about. You know, take that from the new wave, and we're good enough at what we do that the fact somebody is writing pink slime fiction does not frighten me at all. My complaint is not that they are writing it. My complaint is that for far too long, this kind of story has not been told, and we need to fix that. And that's what the pulp revolution is doing. And I'll just leave you with this closing thought before we wrap this up. We need to do more of that. Right now, I have about four people that I can point to. I can point to Rawl and say, look, he wrote Puritans who are brittle, but they are scared. They are in a place. And the things that they do don't look good from where we sit here in our comfortable armchair, but they're understandable. And the things that look evil are not. They're just based out of a natural human reaction to being caught on the first level of heaven and not knowing where to go from here. That's the kind of thing we need to see more of. So you content creators out there, create more content. It's an embarrassment of riches right now, but there's still plenty of room left in the pool. Jump on in.
Yeah, as I said, the trad pub coffers are very full right now. And damned if those won't look good adorning your treasure chests. So fucking go for it, fam. Publish whatever you want, write whatever you want, and put that shit out on Kindle. Like, it blew my mind when I looked into direct to Kindle publishing. You just have to format a Word document properly and you can upload it to Amazon and sell it.
It's just that easy. And if you're not sure, tell you what, everybody, if you're not sure about the – email me. I have a template you can use. All you got to do is file off the serial numbers and put your stuff in. I'll send you a Word document. It's got all of the formatting that you need. So you just start plugging chugging. It's just that easy.
It really is.
And tell me about it because I'll give it a shot. And if it stinks, you'll never know because I'll never tell you. But if it's any good, I'm going to tell everybody you got to read this stuff. You're going to tell Jim and he's going to name drop you on his podcast, just like we've been doing for all these guys. And
I mean, I don't have a whole lot of reach. I don't have a whole lot of reach right now. I get probably maybe, you know, 40 to 100 views on every post I make. But I am willing to help out if I think it's good.
But that's the way the web works.
Exactly.
40 to 100 people read it. And of those 40 to 100 people, 4 to 10 will put it on theirs. And they reach another 40 to 100 people. And they put it on theirs. And before you know it, and like I said, the train's just pulling out of the station. Grab it while it's moving slow, people.
Exactly. Definitely. Yeah. Wise words here. But all right, I just finished my last cigarette, and I'm probably going to have to go and get more. Thank you very much, John, for coming on the podcast. I appreciate you reaching out to me and asking to come on. It was a big But
I'm
shocked that I got to this before Geek Gab did.
Yeah, so remember, Sudden Rescue, that's the one you're looking for. Five Dragons, it's available on Amazon. Hit up Seagull Rising or Puppy of the Month Book Club. I also blog at Castalia House, and I'm going to be making the circuit of like Geek Gab. I'm going to go on there at some point and keep an eye out for me, because you're going to start seeing more and more. You're going to be sick of me before too long.
I really, really hope so. I really, really hope that at a certain point I'm just going to be like, oh, I got to write another post about how John Mollison is releasing a new novella. Just, oh, God. You know, I really hope that that's the way that this goes. But I'll never get tired.
This has been a great time. You know, I'm a fan of science fiction. I love talking about science fiction. And it's been so nice to talk to somebody who's got a good head on his shoulders and is seeing things the way, you know, seeing things with clarity that's rare these days. And, you know, you discount yourself, but you're definitely turning into the voice of the pulp revolution. If somebody wants to hear, you know, if you want to read about it, there's a lot of places to go, but if you want to hear about it, it's you and Geek Gab, baby. So tune in next week when Jim has another exciting interview lined up for you. I don't know who it is, but it'll be worth listening to.
I have been talking to Ogma. He wants to come on the podcast, so that's going to be a lot of fun. I can't wait to talk to Ogma.
Just into your bladder and buckle your seatbelts for that one.
Yeah, no lie. That dude can go on and on and on, which is a good thing, because I can go on and on and on. I'm just going to have to buy an extra pack of cigarettes for that one, because honestly, we could have gone on for another 2 fucking hours if I had had another pack of cigarettes, but...
Well, hey, we'll pick this up right where we left off in a few months.
Deal? Oh yeah, no problem. Deal, 100%. It probably won't even take that long. Just let me know if you ever want to come on the bay. If you've got something that you want to talk about, man, don't be shy about getting in touch with me. I'm not caught up in myself or anything like that. If you want to come on the podcast, usually my podcasts are like, okay, I'm going to turn on the microphone and bitch for an hour, you know? So the opportunity to have somebody on that I actually do want to talk to and have more conversations with is an absolute godsend. It makes the podcast a lot more interesting than me just rambling about shit by myself. So, yeah, just it doesn't even have to take people? That long.
He's not talking to me. He's talking to you, listener.
Yeah, if you want to come on the podcast, if you got something that you want to pimp, if you got something that you want to promote, and you think that my podcast is worth promoting your thing on, especially with my tainted reputation and shit, which I recently just found out about. But if you want to come on the podcast, get in touch. There's a contact form on the blog. You can just email me and we'll work it out. It's perfectly fine. I'm not some big guy or anything. I'm just some drunk dickhead on the internet, as I keep saying. So, you know, I really, really appreciate you coming on the podcast, John. It's been a lot of fun talking to you, and we will definitely, definitely have to do this again.
Peace, love, and pizza rolls, baby. Talk to you next time.
Absolutely. Have a good night, brother. All right, well, that was the podcast. Thank you very much to John Mollison again for coming on. I know I said that like 1,000 times in the podcast, but I really do appreciate it. The conversation was a lot of fun. So right now, if my cat will let me, I'm just going to go ahead and get on with the sponsors here just to close things out. So if you like what I'm doing here and you want to help support me, there are a couple of ways that you can do that. First off, we have the Cat Kimbridge audiobooks. I did 6, 7, and 8 in the series. It's really good military sci-fi. It also qualifies as superversive sci-fi, as God has taken as Red is existing in that universe. So go pick those up if you're interested in listening to me voice act. Fair warning, the first one was recorded on my old microphone, so there may be a noticeable jump in quality from 6 to 7, but it shouldn't be that bad. Then we have Aaron Clary, Captain Capitalism himself. You can find him at captaincapitalism.blogspot.com. He also has a YouTube channel at Aaron Clary, that's AaronClarey. He also runs a consulting business at assholeconsulting.com. He's also got books up on Amazon. They're very good. I've read most of them. I'd say I also did his audiobooks for Reconnaissance Man and Enjoy the Decline, which are two of my favorite books by him. So I was very honored to get that contract. So yeah, go check Aaron's work out. Then there is John E. Boyle. He has contracted me to do the audiobook for his novel Queen's Heir, which you can find on Amazon. And I would appreciate it if you guys would all go and help him out and buy a copy of his book and leave some nice reviews for him, because he has been very kind and patient with me throughout the duration of this health problem that I've been having for the past couple of months. So thanks again to Mr. Boyle, and, you know, go buy his book, guys. Next, we have the affiliate programs. I have three of them, all with companies that I use frequently and have no problem, you know, shilling. So there is the Amazon affiliate account. So if you're going to do your shopping on Amazon, I would appreciate it if you just go to my blog first, jimfear138.blogspot.com, probably where you're listening to this right now. And just click on the Amazon link. You have to have your ad blocker turned off to see the thing, because they give you some special HTML code. But it's an ad, but it's not one of those virusy ads. All it does is it takes you straight to Amazon, and it lets them know that I sent you, and I get a commission of whatever you buy at no extra cost to you. So whatever you're going to pay is what you're going to pay. You would pay the same thing by going straight to Amazon. This just lets them know that I sent you, and I get a little bit of kickback. So I would appreciate it if you guys would use that. If you guys need some comic books, I recommend mycomicshop.com. I also have an affiliate account with them. You have to click on the... I couldn't figure out how to put the link into the GIF that they gave me. So the link is right above the GIF in the text. So just click on the text. It'll take you right to mycomicshop.com. They've got all kinds of stuff. You can also get stuff used if you don't feel like... if you feel like reading Marvel or DC comics, but you don't feel like giving Marvel or DC any money, or you're looking for some classic Marvel and DC comics, they have those. They also have all kinds of stuff. These guys have been an absolute godsend with me trying to complete my Wildcats collection, so I recommend them. They're good people. like, recently, I woke up one day, I got a want list notification for one of the Wildcats comics. I ordered it, they processed the order, and shipped it all in one day. So I'm probably going to see that sometime early next week. But yeah, very good service, highly recommended, awesome. Glad to be helping them out if I can. Next, we have WriteStuffAnime.com. So if you're looking for any anime or manga, they also have a bunch of other stuff like music and, you know, merchandise, videos, whatever. Basically, whatever kind of anime stuff or manga stuff you're looking for, go there. They'll probably have it. Like I say, very good service. I've never had a problem with them. All of the packages that they send are wrapped up nice and neat and very secure. And they also send you sticky notes with your order, which is kind of cool. But yeah, so if you need any manga, anime, whatever else they sell over there, I just use it for manga and anime. That's all I really have money for. But if you're looking for any of that stuff, then just click the affiliate link, and it'll take you right to their website. Like I say, all of this stuff, it doesn't cost you any extra. It just lets them know that I sent you, and I get a little kickback for driving traffic to their website. So that's about it. That's all I can remember at this point. I also have a Bandcamp up with some old narrations from my YouTube channel back in the day when I didn't know how to do sound production. So if you guys want to go over there and get those, you can. There's some stuff over there that's never been published before. That's the only place that you can get it. So if you're like a completionist and you want to get all my narrations or whatever, that's where to find the rest of them. Those are just the holders, though. So anyway, yeah, I think that's about it for the sponsors. And don't forget, John Mollison's new story, Sudden Rescue, is up on Amazon. You can find a link in the show notes. Thanks again for John to coming on. Really do appreciate it. It was a wonderful time. And we'll have to do it again sometime. So yeah, thank you very much for listening. And we will see you all next week, where we will have another very special guest if we don't have any technical problems tonight while we're recording. So anyway, catch y'all next time. Peace out.